A Game of Two Halves by Ebbett. Chapter 1. An Ordinary Evening at the Pub.
"Hey, mate, can you put the game on?"
Harry glances up at the customer. He's a white bloke, wearing a football strip. England, probably. His hands won't settle, and he belatedly pleads,
"And a pint."
He glances around the bar. No one else seems that fussed.
"Pint of what?"
Harry asks as he scans the back of the bar for the remote.
"Ah,"
the man says, rubbing his hands over his beard.
"Lager."
"Right," Harry says and pulls the pint. The remote is nowhere to be seen.
"It's just, sorry, could you... The fucking telly just went black at my house. I've lost my phone. My computer charger's fucked. This is the first pub I found, and it's the 75th minute."
He grabs the pint and downs half of it.
"England are down, and the French bastards... Here, you're not French."
Harry shakes his head. Nice that he's aware enough to assume that a brown dude might be French. But does that mean that he thinks Harry's not English? Or shouldn't be English?
"Kicking our asses, which, given the shit Harry Kane's been..."
Harry pretends he finds the remote and flicks a spell toward the ancient telly in the corner behind the bar. It's a magical pub now. It wasn't when he bought it. Stumbled across the boarded-up windows while wandering around London after quitting the Aurors 2 weeks into training, realizing that he was going to be a fucking magical copper.
"And this was what? A surprise?" Hermione said, rolling her eyes. "We've been to 4 non-magical and 2 magical protests in the last 3 months."
Ron raised an eyebrow and said,
"You know he doesn't process stuff until he's thought of it. Your genius is entirely wasted."
Hermione sighed.
"I just think shouting fuck the Aurors every weekend should have sunk in before someone signed up for police school. It's not rocket science."
There'd been nothing to say to that, Harry realized, so he just started laughing. He isn't even sure the telly will work. He doesn't pay the television license or whatever. It's a mixed neighborhood, but some subtle warding spells and notice-me-nots tend to ward off anyone who doesn't have a connection to magic. Which meant that usually they didn't get men like the one standing in front of him, sweating buckets because 22 blokes were kicking a ball around, and the right ones needed to kick the ball in the right way, or whatever. Harry felt superior for a second, until he remembered screaming himself hoarse at Ginny's last Quidditch match. Glass houses.
"Dive bar meets gastropub,"
Ginny had said, once the renovations... new toilets, no more carpet, were completed. Harry shrugged. He wanted to be normal. It was crowded for a few months. The Savior opens pub. Grab a drink with the boy who lived. Potter's pub. But it was just far enough from Diagon Alley that it soon settled into just another local. The Stag and the Doe. So it was a little corny, but let a boy who'd never known his parents live out some bonding fantasies. Plus, Harry thought, squinting at the telly, who knew if he'd have kids that he could cheesily name Lily and James, since his long singledom endured, despite his best efforts in putting himself out there on apps and accepting all the free drinks and propositions. Not the blatantly sexual propositions, he clarified to himself. But I am trying to get to know many people, so I will not die alone. Again. Well, not that I died alone the first time. It was rather crowded. But whatever. The TV sparks, and some blonde lady washing cooked rice appears.
"Know what channel it's on?"
The man gives him a wide-eyed look.
"BBC Two!"
"Right," Harry says, and thinks BBC Two very sternly at the television. Strangely, the screen goes black and then turns green. The customer moans with relief and settles at the end of the bar. Harry, squinting, realizes that there are some tiny blurs that must be people running around. He needs to get his eyes checked again. He knows it's bad, but since Hermione and Ron moved in together, he's fallen off using the wall calendar they used to share, in which Hermione penciled in all the recommended NHS reminders for annual checkups. He's 28, he thinks crossly. He should be doing this shit for himself.
"Shit, shit, 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 shit,"
the man at the end of the bar starts mumbling. Harry glances around. None of the other customers seem to have even noticed the man at the end of the bar. Or maybe they looked quickly but didn't want to draw attention to their robes or pointed hats, or in another direction, they're completely and utterly queer-presenting outfits, though most of the patrons look both magical and queer. Which is great, but this unknown quantity of a man who seems to be from a group of fans who are widely known as a racist group of idiots who love aggro, Harry moves towards the end of the bar, in case the muttering heralds something worse. Shit, shit, shit! The man is tearing up a bar mat. Harry doesn't mind that. He does that at other people's bars. When he's on one of those I-need-to-not-look-bored dates.
Oh my god, you need to fucking defend against Malfoy! Shit! Fuck! Bollocks!
Harry's stomach drops. Harry says, Malfoy? It's got to be a coincidence. The man doesn't take his eyes off the screen.
The French striker! Oh fuck, he's fucking Grealish!
Harry squints at the television again. A small white dot has shot past a blue one, kicking an even smaller dot toward the goal, and the keeper jumps, but... Oh, good, it's a close-up now, so Harry can see in great detail how the ball sails just beyond his fingertips and slams into the back of the net. The man groans wildly and collapses onto the bar.
80th-minute equalizer, those French bastards,
he mutters into the polished wood. But Harry's heart has just stopped, because the camera pans to the French striker, who's just jumped in the arms of one of his teammates, his blonde hair flying wildly about his face. And when the mob of players parts and he tosses his hair back, it's Draco Malfoy. The camera zooms in on Malfoy, who grins widely, spreads his massively tattooed, Harry swallows hard, arms, winks, and sticks out his tongue. It's very long and very pink. Memory stabs him in the stomach. Half-collapsed over his own bar, Harry rolls his eyes. You'd think he'd have learned how to control this after the whole Voldemort shitshow, or even after years of... But no. Here he is, about to puke at an unexpected Malfoy sighting. Harry? Morwenna, one of his regulars, is leaning across the bar, wand jutting out from her sleeve as she shields it from the TV man. All right? How does she know about... She can't, he realizes, and gives her a wan smile. Yeah, just didn't expect Malfoy to be scoring goals for France. Wait, what? She sends a quick healing spell at him, then glances at the telly. Oh, shit! The healing spell doesn't do anything, not really, because he's not really hurt or sick. But her magic wraps around him just like one of her warm hugs would.
Thank God someone understands! The man at the end of the bar says with a grimace in Harry's direction. 1-1.
Harry tries to look pained at the score. Morwenna, raised by two druids in an 11th-century castle in Snowdonia, blinks at the man.
Terribly bad luck, she says at last.
Here, the man says. Get her another of whatever she's having, and I'll have another lager.
Morwenna glances back at the table she'd left, but her friends, seeing that Harry's not actively dying, have moved back to discussing the latest magical drag club in voices loud enough that they've clearly decided not to give a fuck about the sad sack Englishman anymore.
Thank you, she says, and takes the stool next to him.
Harry mixes her drink, pulls another pint.
Misery loves company, he says,
and clinks his lager against her fresh G&T.
France, though?
Morwenna asks. Her eyes keep flicking back to Harry, who is now studiously ignoring the television. Tattooed arms, indeed.
The striker? Harry blurts,
then grabs a rag and rubs a clean glass.
Malfoy,
the man says with a shake of his head.
Cunning bastard!
He glances up at Morwenna, who gives him an encouraging smile. He suddenly seems a bit shy and says,
Well, I'm sure you know he's PSG's top scorer. After they paid that record transfer fee to get him from Lyon. And that,
he groans,
goal will be his 7th cap for the national team. Left-footed, which is a bit unusual for a striker. And he's one of the few gay footballers.
He pauses and takes a swig of lager. Harry's hand tightens on his wand. Morwenna is very still.
Probably there's more, though, he says with a smile.
Harry and Morwenna haven't moved. He seems to take that for confusion, so he goes on in a bright tone.
Gay lads who play football, that is. Because statistically, there's probably loads of gay footballers, but they're not out. or they haven't figured it out yet.
So I probably should have said Malfoy is one of the few out gay footballers.
Very out and quite proud, he says with an approving nod. And I, for one, think he should be allowed to fucking deck a few of those bastards who give him shit for it.
Harry and Morwenna are still frozen in place. It's not a surprise Malfoy's gay. He's had Harry's dick in... Harry clears his throat to clear his mind.
Morwenna smiles at him and nods.
The first pride was a riot, she says, in a mildly teasing voice.
He snaps his fingers at her and says,
I've heard that on a podcast.
Her mouth quirks.
Mind, I still hate the bastard, he says,
lapsing into gloom as he glances at the television, before he sees how Morwenna's stiffened again, and turns toward her, his voice anxious.
Oh, no, it's because he's French. Not that I'm xenophobic. He's French right now, during the Euros, and he's a fucking good striker, so...
He's back to tearing up the bar mats. Morwenna puts a hand on his arm.
It's okay to hate the French during the,
He looks up, and his whole face brightens.
Euros!
Morwenna nods and pats his arm. Harry shoots her a quick glance, and she raises an eyebrow, so he goes back to polishing the glass and ruminating over the new information.
So how long has he been in France? Morwenna asks, taking her hand back and sipping her drink.
She's acting casual, but Harry knows she can read the interest radiating off him, no matter how casually he's attempting to act, which, frankly, he's giving it a damn good try, but he couldn't act his way out of a paper bag. She was one of his first regulars, woven into the fabric of his life to the point that she'd been at Ron and Hermione's wedding. The man closes his eyes briefly, then says,
His first league season was 2010-2011 for Drancy in the Championnat National Deux, but he didn't come off the bench. Year after, went on loan to FC Mantua 78, started scoring for them, and went on to Cannes, where he got a hat-trick in his first game. So he barely finished the season before there were offers from Lyon, Le Havre, and Nancy. He went to Lyon, and then, after two seasons there, Paris Saint-Germain paid the then-highest transfer fee in League One of 42 million euros, and he's been at the club ever since.
He opens his eyes, casts a beseeching look at the screen, where the score is still 1-1, then looks at Morwenna and...
blushes? Sorry, he said.
Why? Morwenna asks. She twirls a curl around her finger. Harry is getting a vibe here, but he doesn't want to move away because, one, he's still not totally sure about this clearly non-magical bloke in his pub, which might be a statute thing, and two, he wants to know more about Malfoy. Three, he probably shouldn't care about Malfoy. Four, he has to make sure Morwenna's okay and this dude isn't a creep. That should probably be number one.
Brian's always telling me not to do that,
he says at last, his eyes flicking between Morwenna's hand and the television.
Tell pretty women too much football shit.
He stares at the television, the red of his neck matching the collar of his shirt.
Oh,
Morwenna says, her hand falling from her hair. Harry glances over to her regular table, where Dev has her eyebrows raised, and Owen is nodding and smirking. They've been trying to get Morwenna to, you know, put herself out there, now that she's gotten more confident, and Harry's been behind them all the way. But he doubts that this is what any of them had expected.
Sorry, the man says again.
He takes a gulp of lager.
I'm sorry if that crossed a line. I won't, we can just... sorry.
Morwenna presses her lips together to hide what Harry is sure is a massive smile, then allows herself a small smile and puts a hand over his frantic, bar-mat-tearing ones. He freezes.
Don't apologize, she says, though it's very sweet of you to be concerned. I was flirting with you and am definitely going to flirt with you even harder now, and you can buy me another drink when I finish this one.
Right, the man says, and his face bursts into a smile. Also, Brian is entirely wrong in a situation where a lady has asked you a question about football, so... she shrugs. The man glances up at Harry, who nods, not entirely sure why, but it felt like the right thing to do. The bloke turns to the telly and starts mumbling under his breath. Morwenna widens her eyes at Harry. Harry raises an eyebrow back. He's not hideous, this man.
with his broad shoulders and stout beer belly and tousled brown curls and a cropped beard. He seems like he might be employed, or at least he's a generous broke, and he's definitely at least mildly aware of his privilege and trying to be polite, if he's not actually kind. Again, a white dot breaks away from the pack and surges forth, and the man's muttered curses become more fervent. But then he tears his eyes away from the TV to glance at Morwenna, who says, "Oh, no," in a serious voice, even though she clearly isn't following the game, because she's just been watching him. He grins and turns back to the telly and keeps cursing, as, of course, it's Malfoy scoring another goal. Harry thinks it's a bit weird how long the camera focuses on Malfoy's dancing and the team dry-humping mob. Mosh? Celebratory clothed orgy? "Oh, no," Morwenna says again. "That's definitely bad." The bloke raises his head from the bar, sees that she's not mocking him, and gives her a sad smile. "We're out now, unless Harry Kane can score in the next, he checks his watch, 7 seconds. "Oh, dear," Morwenna says. "Fucking Malfoy," he says with a hollow little laugh. "If you don't like him," Morwenna asks in a teasing tone, "why do you know so much about him?" He says and looks back at the TV. I like football. He scratches his beard and then says quietly, "Probably too much." "Too much?" He stares at Morwenna and says in funereal tones, "Well, France has just won, so we're out of the Euros in the group stages, which is the first time since 2016. Before that, it was 1980, 1988, 1992, and 2000 that they didn't even make it out of the group of 16. That's not even a deep-cut fact. Anyone who follows England could probably tell you that." "Okay," Morwenna says. "So what's a deep-cut fact that Brian would say you shouldn't talk about?" He frowns and rubs his beard. Harry continues to polish this glass, studiously avoiding the telly, where Malfoy has emerged from the top of a dog pile and is kissing everyone on the cheek. "Just French things," Harry thinks, jamming his hand into the bottom of the glass. He didn't know Malfoy even spoke French, let alone would qualify to play for some national team. A non-magical national team. Fucking weird.
What's his first name?" Harry asks.
"What?"
"Malfoy."
"Lucien François-Marie Malfoy," the stranger says.
Harry nods.
"Bit long."
"He's French," he says with a shrug.
He looks at Morwenna, then glances away again and says,
"I'm Martin."
"Martin," she says. "What a lovely name.
I'm Morwenna."
"That's a much lovelier name," he says, and nods a few times. "Well, if we had to go out of the Euros, at least I got to meet you, Morwenna."
She glances at the telly.
"I think that man in the blue shirt is crying."
"Oh, yeah," Morton says in doleful tones without turning. "I'd be crying too if I were at home. Like I said, probably too into football. But, you know, trying to impress a beautiful woman is distraction enough. And when you add in a healthy wallop of toxic masculinity, bloke can't just start weeping in a strange pub. Glad Harry Kane can let it out, though."
Morwenna's eyes are wide as a label identifying the player appears, and the camera zooms in on a man who has one hand to his face and his other half-heartedly raised towards the fans.
"How'd you know it was—"
Martin drains the lager.
"He's been watching Game of Thrones, so everyone thinks he's an emotional wreck, so it's just the most logical. Plus," he holds up one finger, "he knows he should have scored more. His XG's 13.3 from Tottenham." "But deep cut fact," he said, blinking at Morwenna. "England hasn't kept a clean sheet in the group stages of the Euros since 1966.
"A clean sheet?"
The man raises an eyebrow.
"Did you grow up in the UK? Not to be rude, but it's just one of those phrases that's infiltrated society to the extent that—"
He breaks off and turns his glass in his hands. Morwenna glances at Harry, then shifts on the stool.
"I was homeschooled. And then, you know—"
She waves a hand around at the pub, bedecked with rainbow flags.
"I'm not a sports queer."
Harry rolls his eyes.
"Homeschooled.
That's a good one for a former Ravenclaw prefect. She widens her eyes at him, and he shrugs, setting the glass back among its friends. Martin lets out a laugh, then his brow crinkles.
Clean sheet means a team doesn't let in any goals, so the score sheet stays clean because it's blank.
Morwenna nods. He taps his index finger on the rim of his glass. Then he bursts out, all the words blurring together so quickly that Harry can barely parse them.
Queer as in no possibility of a date with someone like me? Not that if you were attracted to, men or whatever, you'd have to want to go on a date or anything, but I thought we might be flirting, but then I don't know, so, I'd love to take you out to dinner, but definitely in a date way, because I think you're beautiful, but also no pressure. I can leave here and go home and cry about England and, this.
Martin's face is flame red by the time he finishes. A smile breaks out on Morwenna's face, and then she starts giggling. She can't seem to stop and flaps a hand at Harry, who raises an eyebrow, to which she flaps her hand again and gasps, "You tell him!" Which Harry feels kind of weird about. But he sets two hands on the bar, and staring into Martin's shockingly green, almost a mirror of his own, eyes, says, "Queer as in trans." Martin turns towards Morwenna and smiles at her. She's still giggling slightly, comfortable in the knowledge that any fuckery would bring approximately 2 tons of magical shit-stomping, but tries to compose herself under Martin's gentle gaze. Harry isn't sure if he should turn away, because this definitely feels private, but also he was kind of forced to be involved, so he leans back from the bar and crosses his arms.
"Queer as in trans," Morwenna echoes, "and open to whatever genders in love or,
She flushes beautifully.
"Open to, Martin's?" Martin says, then cringes. "Not that Martin is a gender, like, cis man, I guess, but sort of by default, and then sort of interested in mostly women, but I did try kissing a bloke once at a train convention on a dare, but he wasn't really my type, so I don't think that counts. Like, if I did want to kiss a man, it wouldn't have been him, so not liking that kiss doesn't mean I'm not..."
He snaps his mouth shut. Morwenna leans forward and puts one hand on his arm.
"Open to one particular Martin," she says with another giggle. "If I didn't think you were handsome, do you think I'd have hung around and asked you for facts?"
Martin's mouth drops open. He gapes at Morwenna.
"But you're so pretty, and you think..."
Morwenna grins. He blushes, and then, fumbling in his pockets, his face falls.
I don't have my phone, but I could give you my number, and then I can call you to arrange a date. Don't have my agenda," he says. I wasn't expecting to, meet someone."
Morwenna rifles through her purse.
"Whatever you want always falls to the bottom," she says, dumping a compact, several receipts, and a scrunchie on the bar. "What if, I mean," Martin says, "aren't there pockets inside?"
She shakes her head.
"This is a bucket bag, so it doesn't have any internal structure."
A notebook and a pack of gum join the other objects on the bar. Harry's sure she's just trying to distract Martin from the wand or small crystal ball he knows she's got in there. But then she casually tosses her pointed hat onto the bar, and Martin, without missing a beat, says,
"Cool hat,"
and then continues,
"Would it be possible to make some kind of internal skeleton with pockets, or would that be more annoying than helpful?"
She looks up at him and says,
"I've heard of these, like, bags within bags, but they all seem large, and sometimes you have a smaller purse, and then you'd have to take all the shit out of the little cargo pants or whatever."
Martin shakes his head.
"That's inefficient. What if it could change size?"
Morwenna and Harry stare at him. He sighs, shakes his head.
"Wishful thinking, I suppose."
Then he notices the two of them staring at him. Morwenna glances at Harry, who shrugs.
"So,"
she says, and then glances down and yelps, grabbing her phone. She unlocks it, bites her lip, opens a new contact window, sets her phone on the bar, and then says,
"There's something else you should know about me."
Martin waits for a minute, and then, into the silence, says,
"I'm guessing from your accent that you're Welsh, so there's no chance you'll ever be interested in England winning anything, ever. So what could be worse?"
He smiles at her reassuringly. Harry swallows a noise in the back of his throat. It might have been sarcasm from someone else, but he can tell that there's actually something meaningful to Martin, so it's rather sweet in an idiotic way.
"I'm a witch," she says.
No clanging, No owls dive bombing. No ministry letter popped into existence. The statute of secrecy, thanks in no small part to the efforts of Seamus Finnegan, was now less concerned with individual, interpersonal mixing between the magical and non-magical worlds, and more about preventing potential corporate or governmental abuses of magical knowledge. So unless Martin was a CEO who'd tried to leverage Morwenna's power for profit?
Like a Wiccan?
He didn't sound mad, just confused. Morwenna tilted her head and pulled out her wand. He didn't move. She waved it gently, and a stream of glittering lights cascaded down, falling gently onto Martin's outstretched hands.
"You can make stars," he said hoarsely.
Morwenna flicked her wand again, and the light solidified into red and white shapes, small red lions and white roses that cascaded from the air. A lion landed on Martin's palm and gambolled about.
"Those are the symbols, right?" Morwenna asked. "Of the England team?"
He glanced up, his whole face alive with wonder at her.
"You're so..."
He broke off and then said,
"Amazing sounds so trite, but I can't think of another word that... My God, wow!"
"Well," Morwenna says, "amazing is pretty good." Martin moves his hand to the bar so the illusory red lion can walk off it, and then takes Morwenna's phone with the biggest smile Harry's seen since the pub door had banged open an hour or so ago.
"There," he says, tapping in his contact info. "Now we can go on a proper date. Though I don't know any, magic restaurants."
"Well," Morwenna says with a small smirk, "I'm sure I could be convinced to take you to a magic restaurant as a second date." Harry turns away and rolls his eyes at a jar of maraschino cherries. Chapter 2. Unanswered Questions. Harry swiped open his phone. He opened a browser. Typed. Deleted. Typed. Deleted. Typed. At Lucien Malfoy, Harry discovered, had 5.8 M Instagram followers. Was M million? Were there that many people in the world? Let alone interested in football? Interested in Malfoy? Malfoy holding a jar of Nutella. A loop of Malfoy smashing a ball into the back of the net. Malfoy hoisted on his teammate's shoulders. Malfoy in a white and blue training kit. A black PSG kit. Shirtless in gray joggers. Another loop of Malfoy clinking glasses of champagne with a group of hot dudes in white robes. Malfoy holding a rainbow flag. Malfoy teaching a tiny kid how to kick a ball. Malfoy posting about racial injustice. Harry forced himself to keep breathing. The air caught at the back of his throat. Why didn't he text back? Why didn't he call back? Was it that bad? Was it really that bad? Malfoy's lopsided grin and head tilt repeated again and again as he blew a kiss and made a rude gesture at the camera. La haine ne gagne pas les euros. Hate doesn't win the euros, is what Google Translate spat back out once it had worked out the typos Harry had made, because he didn't fucking speak French. The tiny Malfoy grinned, but there was a determination in his eyes. Harry closed the tab. He clicked his phone screen off, then settled his phone face down on his stomach. Eyes closed, he kept seeing Malfoy's face. Not one of those Instagram faces. That other face. The face he'd made when he sank into Harry, one hand cupping Harry's cheek, the other on his hip. Gentle. Open. Kind. Harry could barely discern his features until he bent to kiss him, hovering a few centimeters away and kissing him again and again. Or the face he made when he came, a cross between distress and agony that mellowed into a beatific smile that lit up his eyes before they even reopened. Harry had only seen that face once. Goosebumps pimpled his body. He stretched quickly to ward them off, but that ache had already insinuated itself into his intestines. He wished he could just be fucking normal for once, that he'd have gotten over this one night. A night that clearly meant little to nothing to Malfoy. who kissed him sleepily in the darkness, then disappeared before Harry woke up. The Malfoy who never responded to any texts, or calls, or owls. Harry blinked back the tears. It was ridiculous to cry over an experience that lasted less than 12 hours, over 9 years ago. He was stupid, fundamentally broken, unable to move on like a normal person, to slow his thoughts from kissing Malfoy to spending the rest of his life waking up next to him. And that just didn't happen in real life. In real life, you went on a few dates with a few different people, and then maybe you slept with some of them, and you narrowed it down, and didn't cry until you vomited because they didn't get back to you, because they'd slipped out of your life. And now, for fuck's sake, Harry was back to crying about Draco Malfoy. It really didn't seem fair. Surely, God or Merlin or whatever could give him a break in the love department. He'd suffered enough in, like, every other aspect of his life. He died for everyone, like some kind of crap wizard Jesus. Everyone said he deserved a great love, that he'd find one day, that there was someone out there for him. But all of those people had found someone, or someones, and Harry was here, reeling from how all the daydreams he'd tried to forget crashed back into his mind. There wasn't such a thing as getting what you deserved. The truth was that Draco didn't want him. Didn't want to be with him. Apparently, he'd rather go off to France and be a world-famous football player. Which, like, fair, Harry thought, squeezing his eyes shut. No one hated him in the non-magical world. He made lots of money playing a child's game. Of course he wouldn't want to get married to his childhood nemesis after a one-night stand and live in a world where most people hated him. But the sadness grew fangs. He was pathetic. Really insane and pathetic and unable to move on. He'd dated other people, but there was always just something missing. Or something that made his skin feel too tight after a few months. Something that felt off. It wasn't the way he'd felt curled around Malfoy, melting into his body and the bed in equal measure, becoming a kind of floating, sinking comfort that elided the space between them. But that was just one night. One stupid night, and one stupid boy he was obsessed with, and couldn't, for whatever reason, get over. "Oh, fuck," Harry said. "I'm basically Snape." Chapter 3. Cursing the Roses. Ron and Hermione lived in a very sweet little cottage just outside a very sweet little English country town in Devon. Harry wasn't actually even sure where it really was in Devon, because he'd only flew there. He bent over one of the white roses that tangled around an arch that separated the front and back gardens, and breathed in its luscious scent. "Son of a bitch, that one," Ron said, lifting his chin towards the plant Harry was sniffing. "What?" Harry had been taken off weeding duty after Ron discovered him trying to uproot what was apparently marjoram. "It demands 3 different sprays and 2 soil enhancers, Ron said, "and it doesn't even do anything except look pretty." Harry laughed. "Yeah, but, like, you got engaged under this arch." "That's the only reason it's still here," Ron glowered at it and turned back to his vegetable beds. "What a romantic," Harry teased, and flopped down on the grass near Ron. Ron grinned. "Hermione said I could rip it out if it was giving me problems," he said. "But I considered that an ill omen. And look, it's still here, and you're still married. Better hope it doesn't get greenfly." Ron glared at Harry, and then at the rose. "If you even dare," he yelled at the plant, "I'll have my wife write a curse that blights all roses forever." "You'll have your wife what?" Hermione said, as she rounded the corner of the house, waddling along cheerfully. "Curse all roses forever if our marriage rose acts up," Ron said in a bright voice, the one that softened around Eleanor. "Cuff," Ellie said, and wriggled her hand out of her mum's and beelined towards Harry. Harry held his arms out, and she crashed into them.
"Has." "Really?" Hermione asked, as if she needed a new word. "Because you know Miss McNulty asked us to watch our language, and now here we are."
She shook her head at Ron, but her eyes were soft.
"Miss McNulty can handle it," Ron said. "She's a witch and a preschool teacher. Toughest woman I know. After you and Mum, obviously."
Hermione rolled her eyes at him. Ellie bounced on Harry's crossed legs, which hurt a bit, so he lifted her up, which made her giggle, stretched his legs out, and then resettled her in his lap.
"Huzzah!" she said, fixing her large brown eyes on his. "Mum, Daddy, and then the owl, Woj, and Fazzes," she broke out laughing.
Harry really had no idea what she was trying to say, because it took him at least a few days to get into her lisping baby voice. He appealed to Hermione and Ron.
"We went to the owlry after we visited Mum at work," Ron said.
"Owl,"
Ellie said.
She hooted.
Harry hooted back at her.
"And there was a big grey owl named..."
Ron waited for Ellie to fill in.
"Wodge,"
Ellie said.
"Roger,"
Hermione said gently.
"Wodge,"
Ellie said and nodded.
"And what did Roger do?"
Ron asked as he turned his attention back to the weeding.
"Snap,"
Ellie shouted.
"Mouth."
"Roger ate a big mouse right in front of us," Hermione said and wrinkled her nose.
"Blood,"
Ellie cried, jumping out of Harry's lap and throwing her fists in the air.
"Snap!"
"Yes," Ron said. "It did make a big snap sound when Roger crushed the mouse's skull."
"Mouth call,"
Ellie said, her eyes blazing.
"Wow," Harry said. "That's exciting."
Ellie was a bit beyond him sometimes. He felt like he was always saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, or not providing her with an enriched vocabulary, or being too complex. He really needed to get one of those fucking baby books so he'd know what was appropriate for a 2-and-some-months-year-old. He was a shit godfather.
"Are you going to get a new owl or something?" he asked,
ramping down the wave of self-pity that was threatening to engulf him. Ellie and Ron nodded, just as Hermione shook her head.
"It's up for debate," she said. "Some people think we need a new owl before Aslan, you know."
"Dies?" Harry asked,
unclear about why she'd broken off and was kind of waving her hands around. Their owl was about 75 in owl years, or whatever.
"Dive,"
Ellie said. She grinned. Hermione raised her hands to the sky.
"Miss McNulty!"
"Babe," Ron said. "Ellie saying death is the least of her worries when she's got to deal with Wulfric Parkinson Knot."
"Parkinson Knot? Like..." Harry ran a hand over Ellie's forehead. She wriggled away and crashed into her dad.
"Yep,"
Ron said, kissing his daughter's head before she giggled and began running around in circles.
"Less of a menace because he's the pug's offspring."
"Ronald."
Ron shrugged.
"She did get a nose job," Hermione said. "So it's both cruel and inaccurate."
"Anyway, we think he's got a learning disability, but, you know, they don't want to hear it."
Ron yanked a weed.
"If they'd known about my dyslexia before, or at Hogwarts, it would have been so much easier."
Harry and Hermione made noises of assent.
"Anyway, she's a saint," Hermione said. "So I want to make her job as easy as possible in relation to our little..."
"Angel," Harry said with a grin. Hermione grinned back.
"Gentle hands,"
Ron called over to where Ellie had taken some plant in a death grip. She looked at her dad. He pantomimed letting go, and she acquiesced and ran back to her mum and began a long-winded story that was completely incomprehensible to Harry. That night, once Ellie, damp and smelling of lavender bubble bath, had been put to bed, the trio settled with cups of tea, Hermione's head in Ron's lap. Harry sprawled across an armchair. A peaceful silence settled over the room. The grandfather clock, augmented with family and friend hands, ticked gently. Luna's hand whizzed from work to home. He knew he should say something about Malfoy. But it was so nice to sit here, wrapped in a house filled with love, and to wonder about what Granger Weasley Baby 2 would look like. It was coming soon. Hermione sat up to drain the last of her tea. She groaned softly as she shifted her weight on the couch. Ron took up her feet and began to massage them. There was so much love in all that wordlessness that Harry felt like he was eavesdropping.
"So,"
Ron said at last,
How's the love life?
You don't have to answer that if you don't want to.
She opened one eye and made sure Harry wasn't going to explode or something. He wasn't quite sure. There was a time when he'd have been enraged or flown into a sadness. But right now it seemed okay.
Funny that, Harry said.
There was a silence. Harry didn't know how to put it. Then Ron, needing Hermione's instep, said casually,
Meet someone?
It's actually weirder. Hermione's eyes flew open.
Is it?
I saw Malfoy on TV,
Harry blurted.
He plays for the French national football team. This bloke came into the bar and wanted to watch the Euros, and then Malfoy scored a goal?
Ron's hand stopped moving. Hermione pushed herself up on the couch. She fixed him with a stare.
How did that make you feel?
She'd read a bunch of therapy books after the war.
Fine, Harry said. You're not spiraling?
Ron asked, holding Hermione's foot like it was a lifesaver. Harry wondered if they had a foot thing, then realized he was looking for things to distract him from the actual problem.
Only a little bit, when I got home, Harry said, and I probably would have the day after, but y'all came over for brunch, the weekend Ellie was with Molly and Arthur.
You did seem weird, Ron said. Harry was about to roll his eyes when he saw Hermione's face.
Wait, did you know about this?
She looked down at her mug.
Not for that long, she said, tired. I was at Waitrose, picking up some milk because we'd run out, and there was a magazine with his face on it.
Harry and Ron stared at her.
And you didn't say anything?
Ron's brow furrowed. Hermione sighed and tilted her head.
What good would it do either of you to know? He's obviously built a new life.
Well, yeah, but he abandoned Harry.
One night stand years ago doesn't...
He took Harry's virginity.
One, virginity is a sexist social construct, and it doesn't mean anything unless...
I know, Miney, but it meant something to Harry, I'm pretty sure, which is why he's been so upset for years about Malfoy running off like that with no...
Surely that's more about Harry's deep-seated abandonment issues and less about the virginity issue.
Anyway, it's fucking Malfoy.
Two, Harry's been doing so well recently, and I didn't think
he deserves...
You know, Harry said, and they shut up.
I am here.
They stared at him, worry etched into their faces, until he felt a pang of guilt and cracked a smile. He set his cup down on the worn, uneven wooden coffee table, making sure the worn blue china wasn't going to lurch over, before swinging his legs around so he was sitting in the chair like a normal person. He wiped his palms on his jeans.
"I have to talk to him," he said.
Ron and Hermione both opened their mouths. Harry held up a finger. They shut their mouths.
I know I can't expect anything. I don't even know if I'll be able to get in touch. He's famous, I get it. But I just...
Harry swallowed. His eyes burned.
I just have to know. And then maybe I can let it go.
The last word was a choked whisper. The living room blurred, so Harry, nauseous with embarrassment, closed his eyes. He felt Ron's arms wrap around him in an awkward hug and heard Hermione's comforting mumbling and knew that whatever happened with Malfoy, he was already loved. But there were different kinds of love, and he was greedy and grateful and beloved. All those things were true, and he got snot all over Ron's front pocket. Chapter 4. Parisian Alleys. Draco rolled over, opened one eye, and jolted out of sleep. There was a man in his bed. He fought the urge to leap out of said bed and peered at the man for a minute, until anxiety about morning breath and logic had him slowly, slowly rolling away. Glasses in place, he propped himself up on one arm and looked at the man. Dark-haired, dark-skinned, with curling eyelashes and a set of broad shoulders. Fuck, was he also a footballer? Only one way to find out. Draco reached out and touched the man's arm.
Good morning, he said in French.
The man raised his head and blinked.
Good morning,
he grumbled back in French, and then put his head back down and shut his eyes. Well, he definitely wasn't someone Draco knew well, or even recognized, and, head suddenly pounding, he realized he was hungover. He padded to the closet, pulled on a t-shirt and some shorts, then went to the bathroom and took some headache pills. He missed hangover potions. A lot. Maybe even to the point that they were one of the things he missed most about the magical world. He'd been worse, though, and he went to the kitchen and prepared toast and coffee. Staring into the light brown sugary liquid and truly thinking about nothing, he started when he heard,
"Good morning."
The man was standing in the doorway to the kitchen. He was completely dressed. Well, his navy blue tie was in his hand, and the top few buttons of the white shirt were undone, but still. Draco felt a bit offended, because that meant the man didn't want a morning session. Then he remembered his manners.
"Do you want a coffee?"
"I don't know your name."
No, thank you," the man said. "I have to get to work."
"Whatever that is." Draco shifted his weight to his left leg.
"Are you..."
The man stumbled over his words.
"I won't say anything."
His stomach dropped.
"About what?"
"To the press," the man said.
"I won't talk to them. This was nice, but I'm not looking for something serious right now. But I know... I suspect. You might be worried. One night stand with famous..."
Draco felt a blush rise to his cheeks.
"You don't have to date me just because I'm famous."
The man swallowed.
"That's not what I meant,"
he said slowly, as though explaining something to a child.
"It was very good. The sex."
Draco's stomach was crawling up his throat. This was the absolute worst, probably because the man was trying to be sweet and explain things, rather than just fucking off in the night like a normal one-night stand.
"I'm not looking for something serious. And with your life... whoever gets involved with you, it's a lot,"
Draco agreed, thinking about Blaze's scrapbook of Draco's conquests immortalized in paparazzi shots. That probably wasn't normal. But Blaze had been happily married to Rocha for 2 years. Rocha, who lovingly rolled his eyes at his eccentric artist husband before going off to work as a human rights lawyer. Why didn't he have a Rocha? Draco thought and pouted.
"Because you sleep around," a voice in his head said.
Draco watched the man's mouth move around more kind words without hearing them. "Because you haven't met the right person," a kinder voice responded.
"Or you did meet the right person and you fu-"
Draco slammed the mug down on the counter. The man in the doorway backed up.
"Sorry,"
Draco said, glancing at the coffee sloshed onto the white marble countertop.
"I'm sorry if you're disappointed," the man said.
"Oh," Draco said, and realized how it must have looked from the outside.
"No, I get it."
He reached for some paper towels and wiped up the mess.
"If you want to get out unseen," Draco said, "give me a minute to get some trousers on, and I'll take you out the back."
He threw the towels away. His hands dried sticky. He pulled on clothes and shoes and led the man downstairs into a tunnel. Dug by the resistance, it was rumored, but Draco didn't bother explaining that. That came up a few houses down, into a house Draco had bought just for this purpose. He opened the door onto the alley and held it open for the man. The paparazzi couldn't get into the alley. There was a locked gate at the end. But since the alley, strangely, but who knew what was happening in Paris at any time, even post-houseman, also started a few houses down from Draco's, they had no interest in it.
Yet.
Draco thought, and tried not to grind his teeth.
"It opens from this direction,"
Draco said, and gave the man a smile.
"Just push."
The man nodded thanks. Draco shut the door and locked it before he started feeling sad. He started feeling sad, though, anyway, as he stared at his long fingers on the brass knob. It would be nice if someone stayed. Or if they wanted to stay, for the right reasons. He thought about praying for a minute. It seemed to help some of his teammates. His footsteps echoed in the empty house. He went back through to the tunnel, back into his own kitchen. His coffee was cold. He took it to the window anyway, and stood behind the curtain, staring at the journalists hanging around.
probably looking for some new transfer market gossip. He'd only been at PSG 2 years, but his star was rising, and there were rumors. Rumors he might want to move to Barca or Madrid. As if he, a media-trained international footballer, would pop out onto his doorstep and blow some potential contract just for what? Fun? They want photos of your latest man, the nasty voice said, because you're proving them right with the gay slut narrative. My life is not an inspirational narrative, Draco said, his angry exhale twitching the thin curtain. Heads turned upwards. Shit. He stepped away from the window. Chapter 5. Memories. 9 years on. Harry and Luna were out dancing at a gay club in a non-magical area of Soho when a shock of white blonde hair across the dance floor caught Harry's eye. But Luna was right here, waving her arms to a rhythm that was definitely not this song's. Harry grabbed her wrist. Her eyes blinked open, the edibles, and she followed his gaze. And, like a cheesy romance film, the crowd parted. Draco Malfoy. Draco Malfoy, in a silver crop top, waving his hands in the air. Oddly, much as Luna had been doing. Harry felt time stretch out like a fruit chew. The crowd closed. His breath echoed in his ears. Luna wiggled out of his grip and vanished into the crowd. He stared at the undulating bodies, bathed in violet light. Draco fucking Malfoy. And then, there he was, one of Luna's arms wrapped around his perfectly tiny waist, watching Harry with a kind of calculating, direct gaze that felt not entirely unlike school, but there was ambiguity where disdain used to lay. Though, Harry reflected 2 songs later, when Draco looped one finger around his belt loop and pulled him closer, maybe it wasn't that ambiguous. Perhaps it wasn't ambiguous at all, Harry mused as Draco slid a hand up Harry's arm. Luna blew Harry a kiss and wandered away. Harry started after her, but Draco slipped one hand into Harry's back left pocket and half shouted, "She's sober now."
"What?"
Harry shouted back. He wished his first words to Draco had been more symbolic. The last time he'd seen him, Draco had stormed away from Harry down the long ministry corridor after thanking Harry with a curt nod. And now, here he was, one hand gripping... fondling? Was that the word? Harry's ass, in public, while he was grinding up on him. It felt like there should be more gravitas. Harry blinked down at Draco, who yelled, "Fine," and grabbed Harry's hand, dragged him off the dance floor and over to the bar, where Luna was eating maraschino cherries. "Are you still..." Harry broke off. Were edibles legal in the magical or non-magical world? It was all a bit fuzzy.
"Oh, no," Luna said. "It wears off so fast. Black family problems."
She shrugged towards Draco, who knowingly grimaced.
"What?"
God, Draco was going to think he was still thick.
"Good to know you've not changed much," Draco snarked, and Harry's stomach clenched.
He wanted to curl his fingers into a fist, but they were tangled with Draco's.
"Black family. My mum was Luna's mum's. One vodka soda and whatever he wants." He waved over his shoulder at Harry with his free hand and smiled at the bartender.
Harry turned around. Draco and the barman both looked at him.
"That's you, sweetheart,"
the barman said.
"Pina colada?"
Harry panicked.
"Okay,"
Draco said with a little smirk. "And whatever her tab is for the cherries." He slid a card across the bar.
"I was going to comp 'em, but she's already gone through half a jar, so thanks, mate."
He winked at Luna.
"Doesn't even know what it's doing to the girl at the end of the bar."
Luna's eyes were closed as she wrangled the cherry stem with her tongue. Her white blonde hair floated down around her shoulders. She looked rather like an erotic angel dreamed up by a particularly horny nun. The woman at the end of the bar swallowed and ran one hand through her buzzed hair. Harry wished he could text her, like, what?
Sorry, she's dating my ex?
Oh, look. You get a cherry too, Draco said, passing Harry the piña colada. Lucky me.
Oh, Harry said. He was fucking blushing. I can't do, that. He jerked his chin in the direction of Luna and her insistently moving tongue.
You can try. Draco licked the rim of his glass.
There wasn't salt or sugar there. Nothing to warrant, said Lick. The world had tilted 43 degrees to the left, and it definitely wasn't the chemicals, because was this flirtatious, smirking man who seemed to like, really properly like Harry? Or at least want to touch him anyway. Was that man the same Draco Malfoy? Did that mean at Hogwarts? Why did Draco keep looking at his mouth? Did he have a piña colada mustache?
Okay, Luna said. Thank you for the cherries, Draco.
She stood and smiled at them.
Practice safe sex.
Harry blinked at her. The blonde glow was kind of blurred. His eyes were super well lubricated from all the blinking, but now he was thinking about blinking, which... He turned, and Draco had dropped his gaze to his drink.
Sex? Harry said, and tried not to look at Draco's mouth. If you're a good boy, Draco looked up, and that was not ambiguous.
His eyes dropped to Harry's lips. He looked away. He brought his glass to his mouth.
What if I'm bad?
Harry asked, his stomach flipping. He reached out and tucked a strand of Draco's hair behind his ear. Draco's fluttering lashes were almost coy, but then, in a disgusted tone that sent Harry's heart plummeting towards his sneakers, he said,
Ugh,
but yanked Harry towards him, then rose on his tiptoes to press his mouth against Harry's so quickly before stepping back that Harry thought he'd hallucinated it until he caught the barman's eye. The barman winked.
Right, Harry said, squeezing Draco's hand. There was no way he was letting go. Not until he'd... But only if...
He chugged the piña colada, his brain jittering from the cold, and bounced on his toes while Draco sipped the rest of his vodka thing. The second Draco put his glass on the bar, Harry dragged him out of the club, up the stairs, down half a block, and into an alley.
Ugh, Potter, at least warn a girl.
What? Draco looked around with a moue of distaste.
Oh, gross, not here.
Harry wiggled his wand out of his tight trousers.
Side along. If you fucking splinch me...
What? Your father will hear about it.
Draco went stiff in Harry's arms. Oh, shit, sorry, Harry said. He'd fucked it up. Of course this was a daft idea. Fucking idiot. Thank goodness he's dead, Draco said at last, rotating his body so he could press his forehead against Harry's shoulder
and wrap his arms around Harry's back.
He certainly wouldn't have wanted to hear about this.
And then he pushed himself up and sucked on Harry's neck, and Harry made an undignified sound and stumbled backwards, bumping over a bin as he clung to Draco. Draco had stopped sucking and was vibrating in Harry's arms, which Harry realized when Draco gasped meant that he was laughing. Laughing at Harry, but with a kind of open, bright giggle that Harry had never heard before. Well, that wasn't true. He'd heard it after Parkinson cracked a joke once when Harry had been hidden by the invisibility cloak, but he'd never had it directed at him.
Oh my God, Potter, so delicate.
He laughed into Harry's chest.
I am not, Harry protested. I just didn't expect you to attach to my neck like a leech.
Draco pressed up against Harry.
He was hard. Harry swallowed. Can you side along while I'm...
Draco fainted towards his neck.
Absolutely not, Harry said,
and trapped Draco's head against his chest with one hand, practically shoving his face into his armpit, while he cast frantically with the other. If Draco started in again on his neck, he would splinch them. They popped out onto the stoop of 12 Grimald Place. Draco's weight pressed against Harry, who crashed against the door. Draco giggled until Harry set him up upon his own 2 feet. He looked up. His smirk faded.
I, inherited it, Harry said. Sirius didn't want it anymore. He scrabbled in his pocket for the key, a heavy iron monster that he shrank and unshrank every time. Drago stared at the key.
You shouldn't need that.
What? Drago shifted from foot to foot. He wrapped his arms around himself, looked down the street, then back up at the house.
If you're the heir, it should open to you. Your hand, your word, whatever.
Harry narrowed his eyes.
You're taking the piss.
Draco glared at him.
Okay, okay. What do I do then, Mr. Old Money?
He tried to put some levity into it, because he'd rather liked giggly, neck-leached Draco rather than this far more familiar, glaring one.
Put your hand on the knob.
That's what he said.
Draco rolled his eyes. You wish.
Harry put his hand on the doorknob.
Nothing happened.
Right, Harry said, and was about to move his hand when a pale one shot out and covered it, wrapping Harry's palm back around the doorknob. Draco's hand was surprisingly warm, for all its boniness. Not that he hadn't noticed that before, but he'd thought it was the club. The doorknob grew warm. Harry glanced at Draco, who, he noted with satisfaction, was at least 4 inches shorter than him. Draco's eyes were fixed on the knob. Then the house let out a gust of magic, a shuddering gasp of efflorescence that washed over and through him, blanketing out the street sounds for a few seconds before dissolving. The knob turned under his hand. Harry snatched his hand back. The door swung open.
See? Draco's voice was smug.
Oh, shut up, Harry said without anger, and set his hands on Draco's hips, steering him inside. The front hall, through which he, Hermione, and Ron usually scrambled in a rush because its chandelier resisted all candles and light magic, was bathed in a gentle yellow glow. Candles bobbed among the jet-black jewels.
What the fuck?
Draco stopped. He glanced over his shoulder and said,
Oh, Potter.
What? The look was filled with pity.
You've never...
He glanced around the hall.
This is new, I'm guessing.
Yeah, Harry said, and squinted at the chandelier.
It's always cold and dark and grumpy.
The house resisted magic, pushed against, rejected, minimized spells. That's just how it was. That's how Sirius said it always had been, and why he was much happier with his little cottage in the Cotswolds with Remus, thank you very fucking much. Free rent in London, though.
That's because you've never asked it properly, Draco said,
and spun around, backing Harry up against the wall. He pressed against Harry. His eyes were dark hollows under the flickering candles.
Asked?
It came out as a squeak.
Asked, Draco said.
He wrapped one of his hands around Harry's neck. Harry hoped Draco didn't notice that he was one breath away from hyperventilating. Draco just stood there. His gaze flickered between Harry's eyes and his mouth.
Well, Potter?
He asked at last, drawing out the syllables of his last name.
Oh, fuck it, Harry thought, and thrust his face forward.
He forgot to tilt his head, so the first contact was off, but it was all soon sorted by Draco's capable hands, and Draco's little moan as Harry slipped his tongue into his mouth encouraged him to push one leg between Draco's and slide a hand from his waist down over his ass. He tasted of alcohol and cinnamon gum and something else that Harry could only, stupidly, think of as human flavor. His tongue probed back against Harry's. Kissing was strange. Fish didn't go around putting their tongues in each other's mouths. Uniquely human, he decided, though that might be inaccurate, because who knows if bonobos or something kissed, but whatever. It was very, very good. He'd never had this kind of urgency with Ginny, then immediately felt bad for thinking about his ex when a very hard Draco was grinding against him and sliding his tongue into Harry's ear as he tried to get his breath back under control, his head thudding back against the wall so hard he saw stars. He ought to think Draco's tongue in his ear was unhygienic,
but he just grabbed Draco's ass and tried to pull him closer. Draco paused and laughed softly.
I can't get any closer to you, he whispered hoarsely.
Harry kissed him again. This time he moaned, more to try to let Draco know how much he wanted him than any spontaneous urge of his own. It seemed to work, as Draco's hands were on the waistband of Harry's trousers searching for the button, when there was a cough. Draco froze. Harry, calmly, as though the bottom hadn't just dropped out of his stomach, detached his mouth from Draco's and peered around his head. Hermione and Ron stood on the stairs. Ron said, and hopped onto his other bare foot. His hair stuck up on one side. His faded orange boxers matched his Chudley Cannon's t-shirt. Hermione, wand at the ready, looked as threatening as a short woman in a fluffy purple robe and silk bonnet could.
"Are you okay?"
she asked, and glared at the chandelier, which had spent the last 6 months defying her.
"We felt the house."
Draco turned. Ron gasped.
"Malfoy!"
Hermione shrieked.
"Shit!"
Ron said, and tried to move in front of his girlfriend, who elbowed him.
"Hello, Granger, Weasley,"
Draco said in a flat tone. He stepped away from Harry, dropped his hand from Harry's neck. Harry grabbed his hips. Draco shot him a look.
It's, Harry
said. Everyone stared at him. His cheeks flamed.
"Oh, fuck it. Draco told me how to get into the house without the key. You just put your hand..."
"Not anyone's hand," Draco interrupted. "Just the recognized heir."
Hermione narrowed her eyes.
"So it's recognized him as the heir now?"
Draco shrugged.
"Surprised you hadn't done it already, frankly."
"I've read at least 5.
"But why are you sucking face?"
Ron blurted. The silence was deafening. The candles sputtered.
"Doesn't everyone want to fuck the Savior?"
Draco's voice was dry. Harry glanced at him. The tops of his ears had gone all pinkish, glowing against his white hair. Ron snorted.
"Yeah, which is why he pulls all the time and brings..."
Hermione elbowed him. Then she bit her bottom lip and looked at Harry with concern. Her dumb mum face, Harry thought. Dumb because it was a face of love, and he'd only seen that face on his mum as a ghost. And he blinked and tightened his grip on Draco.
"Are you sure?"
"Are you sure you want to do this with Malfoy?" the look said. "Do the whole sleeping over, maybe losing your virginity or something thing? The thing they'd discussed when Harry had confessed that he and Ginny had never, you know, done anything like that before they broke up." Harry huffed. "You're worse than my parents would have been," he said with a short laugh. "Can't I bring someone home without a third degree?"
"It's not someone," Hermione said and stared at the two of them. "It's Malfoy."
But Harry knew she also meant, "Is this special? Is this meaningful for you? You didn't want to be drunk. You said that. You told me that. You want it to be special. You said you wanted to feel beloved."
"I think I'll be going," Draco said, but didn't move.
He let Harry pull him closer and twine their fingers together.
"I know," Harry said to Hermione. "I didn't think, but I think it's..."
He begged her with his eyes. "I didn't know what I wanted. I want this. I want him. I'm sure."
"Right,"
she finished his sentence, but in a way that only the two of them seemed to grasp. She leaned against Ron, who wrapped an arm around her. His two best friends exchanged a glance. Ron grinned. Hermione squeezed his arm.
"Well, glad the house is happier," Ron said.
Hermione glared at the chandelier again, then opened her mouth. But Ron, who knew that look, wrapped an arm around her waist and hauled her over his shoulder to her muffled, giggled protests.
"Have fun, kids,"
he yelled back down the stairs. Draco was still turned towards the stairs.
"I should probably... This was a stupid idea."
He sounded very tired and very sober.
"I don't think so," Harry said,
pushing himself off the wall and, his hand still in Draco's, moving around him so they were face to face again.
"I mean, I didn't think that I'd see you again, or that You'd...
throw myself at you? Draco laughed in a tired, brittle way. Potter, you are thick.
Harry blinked at him.
Wait, what?
Draco glared at their conjoined hands.
I'm sure lots of people get very slutty around you.
Well, Harry said, and then his stupid Gryffindor honesty broke through. They are, or rather they do, get slutty, but they don't know me. So how do they know they want me, and not some idea of me? How else can they be sure that I want them back?
Draco glanced up. Nausea thrummed as Draco scrutinized him.
It's not insane, Harry said, unsure why he needed to justify his paranoia and insecurity to Malfoy, of all people. Ramil Devane was just the first.
Draco's brows drew together.
What?
He hissed.
Love potions? Why do you think I have so many wards?
He pushed his glasses up his nose.
There's a lot of weirdos out there. I'm not even that fit.
Reflecting that this sounded like he was fishing for a compliment, he amended,
I'm not hideous, and I save the world or whatever, but I cannot believe someone would even attempt to use one of those evil...
Draco burst, and then snapped his mouth shut. Harry stared. Draco's nostrils flared, a thing Harry thought only happened in books.
If it wasn't so, Draco shuddered, evil, it would be ridiculous.
Ridiculous? Draco glared up at him, his face harsh, but his eyes strangely gentle.
You defeated the Dark Lord?
Voldemort, Harry said automatically. Draco closed his eyes.
Fine, Voldemort.
So why does that...
As if you'd fall prey to a love potion, Draco scoffed. You're more powerful than the greatest evil wizard of the past century.
Love is... Harry said, and then realized he was standing in the ancestral home of the noble and most ancient House of Black, which was now his house, though he was definitely not a Black, holding Draco Malfoy's hand at 2:30 a.m. and talking about love. And he felt a wave of embarrassment flood his body. He blushed and stared at Draco's nose.
What?
He asked, nose wrinkling slightly, which was, Harry understood with a horrified swallow, cute. Draco Malfoy was cute. He said, only vaguely aware of the panicked flashes of the memory of Maribee Gaunt.
Love potions are powerful stuff. Love is powerful stuff.
Draco snorted.
Love is powerful stuff. I'm sure that really wins you a lot of dates.
Shut up, Harry said, and bent to kiss him. It was effective. At least until Malfoy pulled back, giggled, and mumbled,
Powerful stuff,
before sliding his tongue into Harry's mouth. The kissing was good. Harry was stupid with it, his hands set on either side of Draco's face. So stupid with the arousal and calmness and curiosity that he couldn't move while Draco's hands roamed, squeezing and caressing and tangling in his hair. He couldn't move, couldn't think. Beyond a vague haze of,
oh, good,
yes,
good, more.
At last, Draco pulled back. Harry couldn't see his expression through his fogged, slightly askew glasses.
Look, Potter, he said, and Harry felt a pang. Harry?
There was a sigh.
Harry, Draco said, can we go to your room? Or can we at least go somewhere horizontal?
Harry blinked. He'd been a bad host.
That was too forward, Draco muttered. Never mind. Shit, I'll just...
Harry grabbed his hand and dragged him towards the stairs.
All right, Neanderthal, Draco said, flirtily.
How do you know about Neanderthals?
Harry whispered as he tiptoed up the stairs as fast as he could, his sweaty hand tight around Draco's.
There's some in France, he said, sounding a bit distracted and uninterested in divergent humanoid lineages.
They reached Harry's room. He forgot why he cared about how Draco knew about Neanderthals. Not when Draco was making little breathy moans and unbuttoning Harry's trousers.
The next few hours were both seared into Harry's mind and yet indistinct, a set of scattered images or moments. Draco's eyes intent as he ran a fingernail across Harry's nipple, the strangely crunchy sound of the condom wrapper. How Draco's dark mark was ever so slightly sunken into his skin, not raised like the other tattoos around it. And sensations or cascades of neurotransmissions that still, to this day, opened up a chasm inside Harry's head, heart, whatever, and made him hard. Years later. Years. He laughed and stared at the ceiling. He was so fucking stupid. Still enchanted with one night, with the ridiculously romantic notion that the man he'd lost his virginity, a social construct, etc., but one that Harry had invested with meaning, because in some ways he wasn't that radical, would somehow have wanted to date him, or even stuck around until the morning, which he clearly didn't, because he hadn't. Or was the height of idiocy, the hoping that Draco would come back, having also pined for years, and want to, what, marry Harry? He pressed his fist against his eyelids, pressing until it started to hurt. But the tears came out anyway. Nobody understood. Ron and Hermione had picked up the pieces from the moment Harry had crashed into their bedroom, searching frantically for Draco, who'd just vanished from the bed beside him. He hadn't been devoured by the house or secreted in some cupboard because of some Black Mansion curse against gay sex. Hermione's diagnostics, creature's confusion, and Harry's new link to the house, which thrummed like a new heartbeat around him, put that theory to rest. Ron found traces of flu powder on the living room carpet, but none of them could remember if they'd been in a hurry, and Creature was quite old now. He'd been legally freed by Harry, and then again with the elf manumission statutes. He was such a pain about the great and most fucking noble House of Black and the heir of Grimmauld, a house who no one else could really understand, not like him, that Harry had resigned himself to living with a cranky old elf until he, Harry, kicked the bucket. Neither of them would budge. Hermione dropped leaflets about the latest elf retirement complexes, augmented by Harry's loud assurances that he'd bankroll whatever Creature wanted to do, as long as it wasn't at Grimmauld. The brochures smelled horrible as they burnt. Magical photos tended to. At least he'd taken on Nico, who seemed to be some kind of relation. They'd explained to Harry once, but elf concepts of family were well beyond his brain, though Hermione seemed to follow it easily. Nico had a nice attic flat, got paid on Sundays, cooked one meal a day for whomever was around, and did whatever, whenever, as long as the house was clean. They liked Tom Petty and had four iguanas. Creature scowled at their robes, sure, because Creature liked the good old ways, which consisted of a terrifying loincloth tea towel situation that no one wanted to comment on. But Nico was way better at cleaning grout, and he could make a souffle, a feat Creature had never, ever managed. Harry groaned and got up. Nico liked making a big Sunday brunch, and was always a bit put out when Harry didn't turn up by 10. On the stairs he heard Ginny's hoarse laugh. Ah, shit, it was the... fuck. Well, he didn't look that bad in the hall mirror. "Stop it," he said to the house. The mirror rippled. Yeah, he looked right shit in the flat light of the morning. He pulled his hood over his head and faced the kitchen. Arrayed around the long kitchen table, which was piled with French toast, berries, pots, mugs, and a jam jar of wildflowers, were Nico, Ginny, Luna, Ron, Hermione, Neville, and Charlie.
"Charlie?"
Harry croaked. Charlie bounced out of his chair.
"Just in town for a couple of days,"
he said, enfolding Harry into a hug, even though Harry had a good 6 inches on him. Top energy, Harry thought, and flushed, recalling that night at the Dragon Sanctuary. The one that had started with Charlie saying,
"Look, I'm ace, but you need a good fuckmate,"
and ended with Harry liquefied in Charlie's bed, where he slept the deepest sleep he'd ever slept.
"Great,"
Harry said, and moved his mouth into a smile. Charlie released him and shot him a look.
"Just slept badly. Got in late.
He dropped onto the open bench near Luna, who rested her head on his shoulder and said,
"Good morning to you and your Nargle infestation."
Nico snapped their fingers, and a cappuccino appeared in front of Harry. That was why the house needed an elf. Their magic just worked differently. It ought to break Gamp's whatever, but Hermione had been working on it recently, and fuck, he hadn't read her latest paper in the Journal of Magical Society, which, as Ron had reminded him several times, was a big fucking deal. "Infestation?" Ginny asked, her freckled nose wrinkled. Luna scratched the hair above Harry's temple.
"Did you see something?"
Harry fought the urge to jerk away. "Normal night at the pub." He added an extra teaspoon of sugar to his already perfectly sweetened coffee. "Morwenna got asked out."
"Yes!" Ron crowed. "Was it Agnes?"
Harry shook his head. "Non-magical bloke, actually. Wandered in looking for the football."
"Not Agnes?"
"Ron," Hermione said, shifting in her chair with a lurch that had her husband throwing himself towards her, just in case she might have fallen. But she rolled her eyes slightly and said,
"I'm fine, but Agnes is into Alicia. Trust me."
Ron's brow furrowed. He watched her smooth a napkin over her pregnant stomach and said,
"But when we were there and Agnes..."
"Teaspoon," Harry said. The trio exchanged glances. Harry's wicked, Hermione's gleeful, Ron's chagrined. And then they all burst into laughter.
"Weirdos," Ginny said with a grin as she helped herself to another piece of French toast. "Nico, this is perfect."
Nico shrugged.
"But he seems nice?" Ron asked.
"Yeah, he seems like a decent bloke. Had to tell him about magic. He didn't freak out." He stirred until the foam started to dissolve. "He was kind of cute about it. Filled with wonder."
"Can relate," Hermione said with a smile.
There was a silence, save the clanking of cutlery.
Thank goodness they'd gotten away from that topic.
"You've a TV at the pub?"
That was Neville, at the far end of the table near Nico.
"I don't remember that."
Harry swigged some cappuccino, but no one else said anything, so he tried not to sound impatient when he said,
"I'd forgotten about it too. But, you know, what does what it wants, and it magically turned on and showed us the game, so, I don't know, never paid the license fee."
"Weird," Ginny said around a mouthful of food.
"Gross,"
Charlie pointed his finger at her.
"Shut up, Mum," she swallowed. "You live in a hut with a dirt floor."
"And yet I have better manners than the world-famous chaser Ginny Weasley Lovegood," he said primly.
Everyone laughed. Ginny loudest of all.
"Who was playing?" Hermione asked. "Is it some World Cup or something?"
Harry
said, hoping they'd have moved on already, because he couldn't keep this up much longer.
"Euros?
England-France. France won." Hermione shrugged. The conversation turned to other topics. It was still his. The information about Draco, that was. He didn't have to explain yet. Didn't have to endure the gentle smiles or short huffs of loving irritation that he could still be so caught up with Malfoy, with this idea of Malfoy, after all these years.
Chapter 6. Room Service Pastries. The ball flew into the back of the net. Draco fell to the pitch and screamed. They were through to the quarterfinals. Hands, arms, surrounding and embracing and uplifting. Veins thrumming, the clear, clean burn of elation emptied the mind of words. The morning after, Draco's phone vibrated at 7:03 a.m. Message from Ademola. "Hey," it read in English, "text me when you're up. I ordered too many pastries from room service." He was up early. Ademola was probably his best friend, on the same club and national teams, the only one on said team who didn't freak the fuck out about carbs, which, probably, was why Draco had been the only one on that text. Draco tapped back an affirmative and dressed. He set the armchair and desk chair facing each other near the window. Small figures hurried down the street.
Draco couldn't do that sort of thing. Not during the war. Not after. Though pardoned by the Wizengamot because he'd passed information to... A triple knock. Draco opened it to Ademola's furrowed brow, which quickly morphed into a smile. He held out a plate, piled high with buns.
"I think they're called buchta," he said with a grin, "but I don't know if that's plural or singular."
"Coffee?" Draco asked, pointing to the table between the chairs and heading towards the telephone. His guest set the plate down on the table and said,
"I'm sure we can figure out the machine."
"Can we, though?" Draco said. His hand hovered over the phone.
"I could," Ademola said, and grinned. "You probably shouldn't. I remember Marseille. Hair dryers and bathtubs do not mix."
Draco shrugged.
"You should be dead, probably."
Draco shrugged again, heart hammering against his ribs. Magic had just surged out of him, encasing him in some fucking anti-electrical force field like one of those magical bursts that was supposed to have stopped around puberty.
"Do you want a cappuccino or what?"
"Latte," Draco ordered, watching Ademola settle into the desk chair.
"You can't sit there," he said when he hung up. "You're my guest."
Ademola switched to the armchair.
"So,"
he said, and picked up a bun. Then he put it down.
"I'll wait until the coffee comes."
Draco's stomach flipped. He was wearing his serious expression, the one that freaked out opposition strikers when he charged up to them in full defense mode. He didn't break into a smile, but looked towards the building across the street. Draco shifted in his chair.
"Did we?"
Draco asked. Ademola glanced away from the window.
"Did we what?"
Draco was going to be sick.
"You know," Draco said, and glanced toward the unmade bed.
Ademola's eyes squeezed shut with his guffaws, which ricocheted around the hotel room. Draco's face flamed. At last, the defender's shoulders, which were really, truly ripped, and Draco suppressed a jealous sigh, stopped moving and he wiped tears from his eyes.
"Lucien," he choked. "As if."
Draco blinked.
"As if what?" "As if I would sleep with you," Ademola said with a grin. "You're a stick boy."
Draco huffed, but his stomach settled.
"Also," Ademola continued, after their coffees had arrived, "if I slept with you, you wouldn't wake up alone. I'm a gentleman."
He grabbed a buchta and bit into it. Draco followed his lead.
"It's good. People other than the French make good food."
"Fuck off," Draco said. That was one of their long-standing jokes, that Draco was some kind of retardataire francophile lusting after the days of the Empire, that French food was the best in the world, that French art was the only thing worth looking at in a museum, that Paris was the center of the world. It had all started when Draco, who'd been claiming he'd grown up in Paris and attended a lycée, had gotten Camus and Sartre mixed up when Ademola brought up existentialism after a particularly bad loss against Nice. Ademola hadn't said anything in the locker room, just laughed and redirected the conversation. No one else knew what the fuck they were discussing anyway, and brought it up later when it was just the two of them. He'd managed to wheedle out of Draco that he was English, born in Paris. He was eligible for the French national team, which was the thing Ademola had been the most concerned about, so once that was clarified, Ademola stopped pushing. He was patient and confident. Draco would share things when he was ready. And, irritatingly, Ademola had the kind of heart and face that cracked open Draco's heart and mouth. But this seemed like one of those slips that Ademola wasn't going to let go. Not in an aggressive way, no, but in a kindly, persistent way. What had he said? Or done? Everything after his goal was a complete blur. He rotated the cup until the handle was a perfect 90 degrees from the edge of the table. Narcissa used to ask the elves to set all the teacups just so. Her flurried final rush around the table just before the telltale pop of apparitions downstairs. The way she'd pat her hair one last time, before turning towards the door and turning on a smile. He'd seen her 2 weeks ago, but with a proper smile. But was this how it would be forever? Fear sending him straight to his mother's habits? Better than ending up with his father's idiosyncrasies. You, Ademola said. His gaze was intense and kind. You said something... Weird isn't the right word, because that sounds judgmental, but strange isn't right either. Shit, sorry. Unusual? Unexpected. What? Draco snapped. His grip tightened on the thin white porcelain handle. So I hugged you, right? Draco nodded, realized that it was Ademola, so a nod would just get a patient smile and a silence waiting to be filled, and said, I don't remember anything. His brow creased. That's definitely weird. Draco shrugged. Has that happened before? Ademola's voice was soothing, which made Draco's skin itch. He didn't need kind condescension from him, of all people, but his father's snarl flashed through his mind. He bit his lip. It wasn't condescension. Kindness wasn't condescension. Sometimes? Draco flexed his left hand and glanced out the window. When there's a lot of emotion and a lot of people. Huh, Ademola said. Like a blackout? I guess. Ademola waited, but Draco didn't say anything else. So I hugged you and you said something like, Great job, man. And you looked at me with this massive smile and said, I'm not a man, but thanks. Draco blinked. What? You said, I'm not a man, but thanks. He leaned forward and put one hand on Draco's knee. I wanted you to know I'm here if you want to talk about it. Draco stared down at Ademola's hand, mind worrying. What did that mean? I'm not a man? I'm here for you. He squeezed Draco's knee and released it. How was Ademola so calm? Well, apparently he wasn't the one having some kind of identity crisis. Wait, Draco said. Did anyone else hear? Ademola shook his head. His voice soft with worry, he asked. Are you scared? Is this new? Draco barked out a laugh. Yeah, this is the first time I'm consciously hearing of this. What? Draco picked up another bun and ate it. Heedless of years of etiquette training, he said, around partially masticated dough. I don't know what I meant. Ademola shot him a confused look. You sounded very sure. Draco shook his head and chewed furiously. And you looked like an angel. What? He swallowed the final lump. Ademola raised his palms to the ceiling. Beautiful. Beatific. Calm. Inner peace. Gabriel at the Annunciation. Draco grabbed another bun. You seem more like Mary now, he said, as Draco tore into the buchta. Hey, guess what? I'm also a wizard, so I have no idea who the fuck these Christian characters are. Seemed like a step too far at the current moment, so Draco kept chewing. Confused, shocked, frazzled, freaking out, Ademola supplied. I guess Anglicans probably don't discuss the emotional effects of an unplanned divine pregnancy. Draco snorted. Anglicans. He reached for another bun, when Ademola put a hand on his arm and said, You can't eat your thoughts away. Draco took the bun anyway. I know, he said at last, as he bit into and chewed slowly. It's just... a lot. Ademola didn't say anything. He just leaned back in his chair with his coffee and waited. This was how he got Draco, every fucking time. It was how everyone got Draco, because he couldn't stop his big fat mouth from filling silences with lies, with questions, with inane comments, with flirtation. Silence choked him, sat heavy on his chest, brushed its tail under his nose until he couldn't take it anymore. Pansy understood, but he hadn't heard that harsh giggle in years. But Ademola, unlike his dad or fucking Dumbledore, didn't have an agenda. He was just there. He was willing to be there for Draco. To listen and cry and giggle and spam his Instagram likes and internet stalk cute people to see if they were single and scream back at the racist and homophobic chants targeted at them. I don't know what it means, Draco said at last. Ademola shrugged one shoulder. Are you a man? The last word of the question settled in the pit of Draco's stomach. That question didn't feel great. Ademola sipped his coffee.
I'm a man, Draco tried.
It tasted rubbery. Scrambled eggs that came from a carton, crusted over the top and sitting in whitish fluids in a long metal tray, kept in lukewarm stasis. He opened his mouth and stuck out his tongue to clear the nausea. That seemed conclusive.
I'm gay.
That was a cup of Earl Grey, familiar but mildly thrilling, even after all these years.
At least one thing still makes sense, Draco said. I'm still gay.
Ademola smiled.
But what does it mean?
You're not a man, Ademola said. Which makes sense, because that's what you said before.
But I don't feel...
Draco looked down at his body.
Bad?
I don't think you have to.
He leaned forward again and put his empty cup on the table. He tilted his head.
But what am I supposed to do? Do I... Am I... a woman?
That tasted of how petrol smelt. Not bad, but not comfortable. Not something he'd want every day. But maybe occasionally?
A little, as a treat?
Ademola stretched. He looked at the empty plate.
You want some eggs? Gotta get swole, bruv,
Draco chirped sarcastically.
Gotta get swole, bruv,
Ademola replied, slowly, consciously, as a test.
Ugh, Draco said. Not a bruv, apparently.
Soft-boiled?
One or two?
Two,
Draco said, and flopped back in the chair.
Gender troubles take a lot of energy.
Ademola's voice, a gentle rumble in the background. Draco stared at the ceiling and considered. He started out with a numbered list of facts. One. Gendered language had always annoyed him. But that was because he was a good feminist, or a sensitive liberal snowflake, or whatever. But maybe it was more personal? But by four, he'd had a fit when the elves first called him Master Draco, the numbers dissolved into a jumbled rush of memories. His confusion and frustration as a child upon learning that non-magical white men didn't wear robes. Annoyance that Pansy got to wear green nail polish, with real, ground-up basilisk scale flakes. But that was just fashion, wasn't it? The wasn't-its and the justs were starting to make sense. This was a long time coming, this whatever it was, this realization that he, Draco Lucien Lycoris François-Marie Malfoy, was not a man. But his own name didn't taste bad, and he didn't want another body.
You don't have to figure it all out now, Ademola said,
his voice drawing Draco back to the two boiled eggs sitting in front of him.
We should get some books or something. You just want to buy more books.
Ademola grinned.
What else am I supposed to do with my millions? I already got everyone a flat. Watches are so typical.
Draco picked up a spoon and tapped around the top of the egg. He envied Ademola's big family, and how they just absorbed him on holidays and teased him right alongside their little brother, older brother, cousin, nephew, son. One day, he'd take Ademola to the chateau. One day, he'd introduce him to his mom and Andy and Teddy. When he'd come out about the magic. He hadn't used magic for years, not consciously, or at least not in a wand-like sense. His wand was probably still in some ministry basement. But you couldn't even get to the chateau without a portkey. And that was another big conversation, one that twisted in his gut. But there was a more pressing issue. Another cramp in his gut reminded him that he had to ask something else, and he couldn't meet Ademola's eyes.
You won't tell, will you? Because what if they take me off the team, or...
No, he said, voice calm and steady.
I won't tell. It's your thing.
Draco tried to chew the egg, but his jaw wasn't working properly. He felt like throwing up.
I didn't think you would, he said, realizing it was guilt. But I panicked. You're the most paranoid person I've ever met, Ademola said with a grin. I expect this kind of shit from you. I don't take it personally. You've just clearly been through something. Or maybe it's your terrible personality.
Thanks, Draco said dryly.
But the room blurred anyway. How annoying.
You just let me know if you want, like,
different pronouns if it's just us or whatever. You don't have to want anything.
Draco nodded. One egg done, swallowed around the lump in his throat. He looked at Adimola.
How are you so...
And then Draco burst into tears.
Lou, Lou, Lou,
Adimola was murmuring, stroking his hair as Draco came somewhat back to his senses, realizing he'd gotten snot all over Adimola's hoodie.
It's okay. How mortifying, Draco sniffed.
He pulled away and pressed his hands into his eyes. When he opened them again, Adimola proffered tissues.
It's because you're so fucking nice.
Adimola nodded.
Yeah, it's all my fault that I love and support you.
Fuck off, Draco said.
I love you.
That's my Lucien, Adimola grinned. He shot a glance at the chair, then flopped backwards onto Draco's bed.
Come here.
Draco made a face, but curled up next to him. He was too tired to say anything else.
It's because I have a lot of family, Adimola said at last, staring at the ceiling, who taught me how to love. Most of it's just being there when it's shit.
Draco glanced at him.
Sometimes you can't do anything else.
He stopped staring at the ceiling and rolled over, flashing his bright grin at Draco.
And then sometimes you make a shitload of money and can make a lot of problems that once seemed insurmountable go away. But you, my petit biscuit, he said, and booped Draco's nose, which Draco endured with a grumble, should take a nap, or you'll be all puffy for the journos later. You sound like my mother, Draco said,
memories of his mother mumbling brightening spells in front of her mirror as his father raged through the house, his mark burning. And, fuck, he had to tell Adimola the rest of it. He reached out and grabbed his hand.
There's something else.
Yeah? Adimola said. Draco felt sick again, because what if this was the thing that drove Adimola over the edge? What if this was the thing that he couldn't deal with? And then, instead of celebrating with his best friend because they were going to the fucking quarterfinals of the Euros... But it was about being there.
Are you in love with me? Adimola asked,
his voice light but with a slight edge. Not of anger or fear, but something a bit more slippery. Some sentiment that danced upon the edge of knowing that if it was that, if that was a yes, that everything would change, forever, irrevocably. Draco looked into his eyes, so open and kind and beloved.
I wish, he said, because that would be so simple and easy, at least, if you loved me back like that, but no.
The left side of Adimola's mouth quirked.
It would be so convenient. But, yeah, no, me neither.
He squeezed Draco's hand.
So what else is there?
Draco was definitely going to vomit. Chunder everywhere, as that one video went. He smirked. Then, under the questioning gaze of his friend, he sobered.
I think I'll just have to show you one day, he said,
realizing that without his wand, without evidence, without proof of magic, he'd seem crazy. Adimola hummed a noise of assent. He closed his eyes and said,
Time to nap.
Draco stared at the ceiling. His mind was spinning. Wait, their mind was spinning?
Did they work? Was that what felt okay?
Well, it didn't feel wrong, but it did feel new. And new often felt... not wrong, but... Oh, fuck, what was he going to do, and how was he going to... A hand covered his eyes.
Stop thinking, Adimola said. Shut your eyes.
Draco shut their eyes. But Adimola didn't move his hand. So they... This was feeling more okay. Petulantly opened them again and glared at the palm they couldn't see.
I'll count to 10.
Draco sputtered.
How can you even... Your clear eyelashes are freakishly long and it tickles.
Draco laughed until they felt sleep pulling them down and away. They gave in, with relief. Chapter 7 Contact. Harry sat back on his heels and considered the toilet. Considered his life. The toilet was a great symbol for his life.
this particular toilet especially. He'd replaced the ancient avocado green one with this shiny, brand-new toilet, all white porcelain and trendily mounted to the wall. What else was his fortune going towards? Well, about 24 charities and his foundation, which was dedicated to anonymously donating scholarships to Hogwarts so kids would be able to do shit like go to Honeydukes or get nice robes for the Yule Ball. But that was all capably run by Edwina Pforzheimer Nkembe, who had just beaten him to the last bottle of green ink at Flourish and Blotts, when she'd realized she didn't have any galleons and they didn't take debit cards. Harry had stood her the ink and, after a coffee, at which she told him how she'd tried to cajole the Hogwarts elves into making jollof rice and created monsters because they'd discovered the power of spices and there was no going back. She'd been just out of school, top marks in charms, but not quite sure what to do next, and Harry had offered her a job as the head of his foundation. It hadn't existed, not when he'd shaken her hand and said he'd send her an owl with a proper contract, but he was down at Gringotts a few minutes later to make it all proper under the watchful eye of Riskel Slisky, the magical world's first vampire lawyer. Slisky's centuries of experience made him very efficient. Harry sat back and considered the toilet. It was now battered, a bit worse for the wear, which was fine, until a magical bachelorette had wandered into his little pub and someone, somehow, had stepped into the toilet. Ministry employees? And it had fallen off the wall. Plumbing was still considered exotic in the magical world, so here Harry was, scrolling through his phone and trying to remember if Dave was the plumber or from Grindr, and then he scrolled past a name that made him roll his eyes and bark out a short laugh. At himself, mostly, because who would keep a contact with a number that hadn't worked in years? The number had never worked. It was probably a fake number. And yet, through all the phone upgrades and contract purges, he'd kept that contact. Who would do that? Only a nutter, he said, and scrolled back up to Dave. It turned out Dan was the plumber. Dave, from Grindr, was now a happily married stay-at-home dad of two, who apparently thought Brixton and Peyton were cute names, but how he'd ever sucked that man's dick was a mystery. Dan couldn't come for a week, and Harry was too tired to call another plumber. He'd just shut the pub for a week. He tapped out an announcement on the pretty derelict Facebook page, hoping someone would see it and spread the word among the regulars. He made a shitty sign and taped it to the window. Then he looked around the bar and sighed. It was 2:30 p.m. on a Saturday. "Just you and me, old boy," he said to himself and rummaged around for a lime. One G&T allowed, then a nice curry takeaway, and crying into your pillow. He ought to get a cat or something. Bookstores had cats. Why couldn't a pub have a cat? He scrolled through local animal shelters, and, half a drink in, called a few, and booked an appointment for the next day. He was going to get a fucking cat. And then he could truly be a crazy old witch, and that was just fine. He leaned back in the booth and stared at the semi-darkness of the pub. And then, God knows why, he looked at the telly. It wasn't like he thought about it. It just happened. It was only because it had last been on that channel that football was what had popped up. And Harry, lacking a channel changer thing, remoter? God, he was turning into Arthur. And since the telly suddenly had decided not to respond to the telekinesis that had turned it on, he squinted over at what appeared to be a football pitch. But there wasn't anyone on it yet, just pundits or whatever, chatting pitchside, and then flipping back to a studio where people were tapping away on tablets and discussing team sheets.
"Malfoy had an assured start, unless something's happened on the training ground that we don't know about," a man in a dark suit said.
The other pundits, two older and one younger, nodded.
"Is Malfoy the best number 9 in the world right now?"
one of the older ones asked, seemingly just to have something to say.
"Even though he's approaching 30, Malfoy just seems to get better and better with age."
"Like a fine wine," another quipped.
Harry groaned.
"He's scored over 16 goals in this Euro so far, a record for the tournament. At least in its current iteration, because, as we all know, Vassoy Balash,
who played for the Hungarian national team, scored 18 goals in the 1964 European Nations Cup for his country, though they lost to Luxembourg in the semi-finals, the other younger man said with a broad smile. As we all know, the other old man said in a thick Scots accent, his words dripping with sarcasm. Malfoy's combination of strength and agility, and between his footballing nose, the first man grinned, and his particular talent of winning penalties with just the right amount of agonized bravery.
Fucking Buckbeak, Harry said, and slammed back the rest of his drink.
He couldn't turn the TV off, though, seemingly, so he went back to the bar and poured himself a glass of orange juice. Perched in front of his own bar, which was a weird sensation, he scrolled through his phone for something to do. And found himself on Instagram. And, well, he might as well. So he found Lucien Malfoy and, carefully avoiding his story because, God knows, he might be vain enough to scroll through the thousands of usernames and see a certain Potty Potter and, no, Harry scanned his page. 2 minutes ago, he'd posted from what looked like a dressing room, a selfie with some teammate, both shirtless because, of course they'd be, chiseled abs angled just so above football shorts and those dumbass socks or whatever. Harry fought the urge to roll his eyes at the 2 million likes. The caption was, according to the translate button, "You are my world, brother. I love you." The comments were all some variation of, "Lucien, I love you," and "Allez les bleus," and "Your friendship is so pure," and "Ademola, my brother," and then, "Are you dating?" followed by a rainbow flag emoji and about 20 hearts. Harry dropped his phone. It clattered to the floor. He blinked up at the TV. The pundits were talking about tactics, whatever that meant, and there was some disagreement over whether France would start a back three or a back four, whatever the fuck that meant. It cut to a woman standing by the pitch, talking excitedly about how the crowd was settling in and discussing the latest on some player's injury. He patted the bar for his phone, then cursed and slid off the bar stool and groped around in the sticky darkness until he found it. He really needed to mop. That's what he should be doing, Harry thought. Cleaning and doing something useful. Doing literally anything than what he was about to subject himself to, which was going to be researching this other dude in this photo, while gnawing on his cuticles and downing a beer. Which is what he did, only half paying attention to the game because, frankly, it was a bunch of blokes kicking a ball around on a pitch and shouting at each other, and he was far too relieved to see that this Ademola was quite far away from Draco on the pitch, as though that meant something. Ademola Moussa seemed super fucking cool, frankly, which made Harry even angrier and more confused, because how could someone who grew up in refugee camps and a Parisian banlieue be Malfoy's best friend? Malfoy had probably charmed him with that cool, enticing gaze and his Jedi mind tricks and tricky snake ways, and was just in it to benefit off Moussa's charity work. Harry realized his beer was steaming. The pint began to boil. He let go, and the bubbles subsided. Fuck. He was going to have to go back to Maurice, because this shit was...
Goal!
Harry widened his eyes at the TV and watched, as Draco, just like last time, danced around and joined in the sexy man mosh pit. And then, as a camera zoomed in as he broke away, fucking winked at the camera. Wanker, Harry said, as a fierce heat bloomed in his stomach. He spent the rest of the game glaring at his pint until its temperature dropped to drinkable. It cleared his mind to do it wandlessly. It wasn't like he needed to see more of this cheering Malfoy, or see Malfoy's chiseled abs when he wiped the sweat with the hem of his shirt, or watch Moussa lift him up and carry him around the pitch when France made it to the semifinals. He went to the bathroom, realized the toilet was still broken, but he didn't really have to pee. He had the fastest orgasm he'd had in months. Fuck, he said. Fucking fuck. Vanishing the evidence, he leaned against the tiled wall. This was crazy. He was crazy. It was all a thing that he should have been over years ago. And yet. He couldn't stop pulling at that thread. It felt like fate. Or, okay, maybe he was deluded, but fuck it. What about his entire life hadn't been crazy?
He pulled his phone out and searched Euros semifinal tickets. Chapter 8. Prophecies and the Prophet. They won the semis, which was fucking amazing. Draco got a hat trick. Now they were on 19 goals, beating that Hungarian's record. And he'd poured one out for the man, because he was dead, and also he'd been hot when he was younger, and Draco appreciated talent and looks. It didn't mean anything that he had dark hair and a piercing gaze. Everyone was into that. They switched from they to he in his mind, from his public persona to their private, being, Draco supposed, around Ademola and his family. Mom and Andy and Teddy hadn't even been phased, probably because Teddy's gender had fluctuated their whole life. "Welcome to the dark side," Teddy joked on the video call. "We have cookies."
"What the fuck?" Draco asked.
His mother chhed. "It's a meme from the 90s, Teddy said and rolled their eyes. "You were alive then."
"I was a wizard racist in the 90s, Draco said dryly.
His mother waved a hand at both of them. "Congrats on the gender," Teddy said, flipped Draco two fingers, and wandered away. Andy shook her head. "They're just sulking because Victoire's in, what was it again, Tanzania for the summer doing something with Sissa?
Setting enchanted traps for elephant poachers."
His mother's eyes sparkled.
"Mum?"
"I just gave her a few black family ideas," she said. "She's practically a black."
"She's a Weasley, but fine."
Draco folded their arms. She wouldn't give them black family curses.
"One, you do not use magic regularly," she said as though she'd read his mind. "Two, you do not need black family curses. Three,
can we get back to me having a gender identity crisis?"
Andy leaned over in front of his mother. Her face took up the whole screen. "Draco, darling, we support you whatever you want to do or be named or anything.
But,"
she said, somehow moving so that Draco could only see her mouth, with the crooked bottom teeth and the gap between the top two front teeth,
"this does not seem like a crisis. You seem very calm. We love you."
"Andromeda, move back,"
his mother's voice was muffled.
"Yes, yes, but they don't connect with you when you're so far away," Andy said,
but then they could see their mother again. "It's like you're on television."
"They are on television," Maman said sharply, "because they are a famous muggle footballer."
"Non-magical?"
"Yes, non-magical."
"They're not on television now," Andy said. "Just this little box."
Draco cleared their throat.
"Back to me and my crisis."
"Not a crisis, just an awakening."
"Yes, but what if I get fired because I'm not a man and I play men's football?" Draco moaned.
The women exchanged glances, then shrugged simultaneously.
"You come back here? We don't need the money. Just write a book or take a painting. We'll sue the football mugwump."
"Mama, it's not a mugwump," they said.
His family was so out of it, off in their own little world as they had been for years now, because between being on house arrest until the full story came out, and then being practically on house arrest to avoid being AK'd by escaped Death Eaters, and then what was the point of going anywhere anyway? "Everything could get delivered," Mother would say with a shrug. "Paris is loud and dirty, and London is worse."
"It'll be fine, Draco," Andy said. "Just stop worrying."
"You haven't told anyone anyway,"
their mother said. She tilted her head and looked at them.
"Save it for the right moment."
"I told Ademola."
"Of course," she said, "because he is almost half your heart, and he will not tell. He's safe. But when do you tell him about us, about the real you?"
"Mama,"
Draco said, fighting to keep the whine from their voice.
"Why do you always have to ask me if I've told him or not?"
"You love him."
"Not like that."
"I want to know the people who are important to you," she said. "You know that."
She glanced up at Andy, who had stood to stretch one arm, and swept her hand across her pinned-up hair. Andy nodded.
"He,"
his mother paused dramatically,
"is coming back to you."
"What?"
Draco's stomach plummeted. There was only one he. Harry James Potter. Erroneously, fucking Merlin, how erroneously, after that infamous, wonderful, horrible night, Draco had vomited on the portkey, stumbled up the chateau's central staircase, and crawled into Mama's bed and sobbed until there were no more tears. She let him sleep, and then, in the twilight of the next evening, had wrapped her arms around him and held him until his heart had cracked right open and he told her everything. He wasn't worthy of the kind of adoration that had flashed across Harry's face, bright and open and unafraid, something that was already only a breath away from love. He'd lost his virginity months before, but his mother smoothed his hair back and kissed his forehead and said, "But this is the time that mattered, my darling Draco." Since then, there had only been one love in Draco's life, in Narcissa's mind. She wasn't wrong, Draco discovered, finding some kind of inborn flaw in that whenever someone else got excited about them and wanted to love them, their stomach turned, and the other person got green eyes. It was some kind of fucking Potter mania. Betrothals or something. Something weird and bizarre. They were doomed.
"Don't be silly,"
his mother had said years ago when he broached this after a particularly tragic ending to a summer romance.
"You're just... well, a black."
"What does that even mean?"
"Cursed, my darling, by a deep and misplaced sense of loyalty."
She put her silver hairbrush down on the table.
"Misplaced in that we cannot exactly control who we love. And who we love often sticks in a way that others do not seem to experience."
She braided her hair into two long plaits, rose, and sat on her bed. Draco was sprawled across the end of it. She waited until he turned his head to look at her.
"Andromeda fell in love with Ted. That was it. There's no question of whom one would pick between your beloved and your family."
She tilted her head.
"Sirius and Remus."
Draco turned his head back to the canopy above her bed. Gray, with silver flowers, something she'd embroidered as a wedding trousseau. Something that had never seen the light of day because it wasn't emerald green.
"Your father and I," she said at last.
Her voice became dreamy.
"He was always a fanatic. But once I had you, you were the only person who mattered to me anymore. And, oh, darling, don't cry."
"I just, it's not fair," Draco sobbed. "I shouldn't get only one chance at loving someone."
"Oh, no, no, no," she smoothed his hair. "It's not like that. You'll..."
Her hand stilled. When she spoke again, she was staring at something Draco couldn't see. Panic pricked his gut.
"You'll come back to each other. Your lives are intertwined, and you will find each other again in that way. But whether that is forever or not is up to the two of you. You can only wait."
She shook her head.
"I'm sorry, darling, but I can't see anything else. But it's not something like a soulmate, or whatever this muggle book Andy's been reading is about. You don't have to be bound to love only him. You can fight it. Bella did."
"Auntie Bella ended up insane, so great."
"Bella didn't end up insane because of this,"
his mother said.
"Look at Andy and Claudine. They're quite happy together. She loves Claudine in a different key than Ted, but no less, just differently."
"I don't want to be a sexless old lady," Draco moaned.
She tweaked his ear.
"They do not have a sexless life, trust me,"
she said tartly.
"You won't be anything you don't want to be, Draco Lucien Licoris François-Marie Malfoy."
They blinked back to the present, and saw Mama and Andy staring, their faces concerned.
"I'm fine," Draco said. "Just spaced out. Sorry."
"Have you felt anything?"
His mother was keen on these things, the things beyond the senses, which she insisted mattered and were real, and Draco rolled their eyes and tried to comprehend whatever it was. But the longer they stayed away from magic, the harder it was to find that spark of faith it relied upon.
No, Draco said. Is that the time? I have to run to training. Bye. I love you. They slammed the laptop shut, not even bothering to close the call, because they couldn't face those two anymore. Their concerned, slightly conniving faces drawn together in worry, their almost identical brows wrinkled with anxiety.
It's fine, Draco said to the empty hotel room. I don't care.
Draco's phone buzzed. Text from 44-1632-960-357. An unknown contact. Probably spam. But he pulled it out of his pocket. Thought you might want to see this, the message said. There was a photograph attached. It was of the Daily Prophet, a cover story with the headline, Boy Who Lived Loves Football? With a giant animated photograph of him, the boy who lived. Only now, he was the very fine man who lived, with his wild hair and neatly trimmed beard, as he confusedly sat while the Italian fans around him jumped to their feet, screaming and hugging each other. That must have been when Argentieri scored from the penalty that... Draco shook their head and tried to focus. Potter must just be into the Euros because he didn't live under a rock like most of magical society. Potter must have attended the Italy-France game and sat in the Italian section because he liked Italy. Maybe his mother was Italian or something? Was his dad Italian-Indian? They knew from their Potter research that that was not true. These things were not true. The truth was that Potter had no idea what was going on, which meant that he was there for some other reason. Which, unless Potter was dating an Italian football fan, but it didn't look like the people around him even knew him, let alone wanted to touch him, and they certainly didn't know who he was, that is, a famous person, meant that he was at the France-Italy game because he wanted to see... That was absurd. Draco locked their phone. They placed it on the bench. They tied their football boots. They were now the last person in the dressing room. XXP, the last line of the text read. She knew what she was doing. She hadn't spoken to them in years, not since they'd said they were leaving the magical world behind. And she left a hole in their heart at least the size of a boiled egg. Or a grapefruit. They placed the phone in their locker. He ran out on the pitch. Chapter 9. Bad Signal.
Harry, we're just concerned because we saw the Prophet, and we think it might be good if you came over and spent the weekend with us, because, well, we're not quite sure that...
Signal's really bad. Sorry. Love you. Bye, Harry said, and hung up.
He was on a train to Paris. Chapter 10. The Final. They had to stay in a team hotel, which was so fucking annoying because they all had apartments in Paris. So they were sulking in a king-size bed, missing how their own sheets smelled, and complaining to Adimola about how the Germans used two separate duvets, and that was so smart.
It's true, you don't share well, Adimola said. Not that you have anyone in your bed long enough to share a duvet with.
He said it jokingly, but stiffened when he saw Draco's face.
You're right, Draco said, and sat up.
Draco shut their eyes.
My name isn't Lucien. It's Draco. And also, I used to be a wizard.
They must have blurted that out because all they heard was,
Wait, what? It's Draco Lucien Licoris Francois-Marie Malfoy, not Malfoy, they said slowly. Licorice? It's a family name, but that doesn't really matter. It's your name, Adimola said, his tone serious. It matters to me. He was a shitty, racist wizard, Draco said, not really knowing if that was actually true, but assuming that anyone that far back in the Black family tree probably was. Wait, like a Wiccan? No, like actual magic, Draco said.
They squinted their eyes shut and tried to call on some inner magical forces to let them do something, and nothing happened.
I haven't used it in a while, but... Ugh, you remember Marseille? That was magic.
You've never been to my family's house because you have to get there by magic. It's protected because we were in the Civil War, and my mother was a double agent, but... Look, sorry. This is fucked up. Sorry, Draco said, and rolled over and smashed their face into the pillow. There was silence. The bed creaked, but the weight didn't change.
How does this relate to the duvet?
Because I've been in love with this boy. God, he's a man now. He has a fucking beard, but they call him the boy who lived still, which is frankly ridiculous and belittling, but anyway, I've known him since we were 11, and he basically saved our world from magical fascism, or racism. I'm not entirely sure how it translates most accurately. Terrible prejudice. But anyway, we were nemeses in school because that's what happens when you don't have any queer people in your world. And then he didn't know I was a spy, and then he cut me open and I almost died, and then we met at a dance club after we graduated and made love, which is sickening to say because I have a reputation to uphold, but I panicked and left immediately when he fell asleep and haven't spoken to him since. And then he came to one of our games and... He broke off with a groan. Draco opened their eyes. I can't love anyone else, apparently, and it's very stupid.
No, Adamola said, his gaze and voice steady. It makes sense. I'm glad it makes sense to someone.
The orchid next to the giant television was blue. Some kind of dye, Draco presumed, and wondered a moment about the science of it all. Things they'd never understand how they happened without magic, and they couldn't escape the truth of it all. No matter what happened about Harry, they had to go back. They had to get their wand, even if it was only being held as an exhibit. They had to talk to Pansy. They had to introduce their family to Adamola.
Is he coming tomorrow?
Draco's stomach flipped.
I hope so.
Harry squints down at his ticket and tries to follow the directions and the flow of the crowd, but when he gets to what seemed like the fourth ticketing checkpoint, or whatever it's called, the guard starts muttering to one of the other guards, and suddenly he's being escorted down a hallway. Is this a counterfeit ticket?
This way, sir, the guard says in a French accent.
Merci, Harry says. Merci.
That was the extent of his French. No, wait.
Bonjour. Pardon. Fromage.
They emerge somewhere that seems very close to the grass. Everything is very large. Or Harry is very small. The guard gestures to an empty seat at the end of a row in an area filled with very attractive women, some with children, and a few older people. Harry glances down. This definitely does not match the number on the ticket. But someone will come along later and yell at him, so he sits down in the seat and smiles at the woman next to him. She's wearing a hijab and what seems to be the French team shirt, and starts speaking to him in French. He gives a grimace that's clear enough because she tries Arabic, then English, and brightens as he understands.
Fatima, she says with a smile. I'm Tariq Khalid's wife. Who is your...
She breaks off, not seeing a ring on his hands, and continues,
Boyfriend? Partner? Brother?
Harry blinks at her. He cranes his neck to look down the row of seats. Ah, that's why everyone here is beautiful, and wearing the team colors. And then there's him, in a gray t-shirt and black jeans and black Vans, like this is the goth convention. At least he trimmed his beard. But that has to mean something, that he's sitting with the families? Wives?
Malfoy, I guess, he says,
trying to make it sound French, and flexes his hands against his knees.
I don't know anyone else.
Lucien is so sweet,
she says with a wide smile, as though what he had said wasn't at all strange.
I'm happy he's found someone.
Harry manages to survive small talk with her as the stadium fills. Then the teams come out. His heart plummets into his stomach as the France players walk onto the pitch, waving at their families and at the fans. And there is that shock of white blonde hair, and Harry can't see the expression on Draco's face, which is definitely turned in this direction. Draco sees him immediately and fights to keep breathing. Adamola had confessed, told them to look out for someone in the family area,
Merlin knows how. But Draco had hoped, and there Harry was. Thank Merlin next to Fatima, who wouldn't be too nosy. And the roar of the crowd felt like the rush of the sea. He's wearing gray because he's a total idiot, Draco thinks, and wants to kiss him. Maybe it's because Draco knows he's there, but it's never come more easily. By halftime, they're up 3-0, and it was Draco's hat trick. Harry doesn't cheer, just leans forward in his seat, clutching the scarf that someone must have pushed onto him, in a mass between his two hands, his mouth tight. Draco wants to feel his lips open up against their own, linger in the unfolding. The team talk is a blur. Everything is a blur. Everything except what feels like this thin, golden thread that's growing between the two of them. Can Harry feel it? Is this what their mother always meant? They win. Because of course they do. Because it's right for the narrative. And then, in what's less right for the narrative, Draco hits their head against Ademola's elbow, and it really fucking hurts and sparks tears in their eyes. But it's also clear when they're blinked away. There's a cup and champagne and whatever. It makes sense now, what Maman said, that it's just obvious. They'd choose Harry. Over all this noise, over all this joy. Harry has tried to give Fatima the football scarf back several times, but she's herding him down the hallway so efficiently that even though he knows she wouldn't physically stop him from leaving, he couldn't do that to those kind, hopeful brown eyes. "You must be so proud," she says as they reach some kind of banquet room. There's a buffet. Champagne. Lots of men in suits. Lots of French. Harry looks at her. 23 goals. I don't really... Do you want some food? She shoots him a look. It's probably not halal. His eyes narrow. Isn't your husband also Muslim? Fatima laughs and nods. Isn't he one of the ones who just, you know, won the fucking Euros? Shouldn't they, you know, make a fucking effort? He can feel his blood pressure rising. The French, she says with a grimace. Haven't you heard they are very welcoming? Yeah, well, that's bullshit, Harry says, and glances around the room until he finds the oldest white man. He's sitting down at a table surrounded by lackeys. Before Fatima can stop him, he marches over, taps the man on his shoulder, and launches into some kind of tirade that still hasn't died down when the team enters to a roar of applause. Draco walks in and sees Harry locked in argument with the last holder of French's international goal record and the current head of the French FA, because of course he would be. But instead of Armand yelling back, he pats Harry's arm and snaps his fingers at some assistant, and there's some bustle. But Draco stops paying attention because Harry turns around. He grins at Draco, then holds up one finger. Irritation spikes along Draco's spine. And then they remember. It's been 9 years. They were the one who crept away. Now they're in the same room. They can take a few minutes of agonized waiting while Harry does whatever the fuck he's doing. Harry pushes his way back to Fatima and launches himself into conversation with her before Tariq surprises his wife and spins her around. And Draco thinks, well, I don't want to wait another 9 years, and marches over and grabs Harry's hand from behind. Harry looks down, like it's normal, like any of this is normal, and then continues, he's getting someone to get a takeaway truck, but he's assured me that this is never going to happen again. Fatima laughs, her hands over his mouth. I can't believe you! She rests her head against Tariq's shoulder. He just yelled at Armand Duclos because there's no halal food. Tariq's eyes widen. Armand Duclos? Draco squeezes Harry's hand. He's just like this, Draco says. Anyone would have done that, Harry says, even though it feels like his body is slowly burning up as heat migrates up his arm from their conjoined hands. Draco doesn't seem affected. He's probably got some hot shit metabolism. Even his hand feels muscular. The last time Harry did a sit-up was, oh God, maybe last May? Fatima and Draco exchange a look. Why don't you two go talk? She suggests. This is a beautiful, gloriously kind congé. One that Draco accepts with a grin and a sickening turn in the stomach. But there's one more thing. There's someone you have to meet, they say, and drag Harry over to the buffet, where Ademola peers at the caviar.
Not even Beluga, he says with a grin, as if they didn't get enough money from Gazprom for this tournament.
Draco can't speak suddenly. Ademola and Harry stare at them, and then at each other. Then Harry smiles, because Draco's the one holding his hand, and asks,
Ademola Musa?
The same, he says with an answering smile, and shakes Harry's free hand. Draco is not letting go of the other one.
You're the world-saving golden boy, I assume. Man, though, given the beard. It's a good beard.
Harry laughs.
Harry, he says. Oh, I knew that. Harry James Potter,
Ademola grins.
6'4", owner of one Stag and Doe pub in London, godfather of one Eleanor Granger Weasley and one Theodore Lupin Black Tonks. Favourite colour purple. You love a good gin and tonic and...
He pauses because Harry and Draco have both let their mouths fall open. Ademola shrugs.
Between Blaze and, well, ways and means, can't just let my Lucien go off with just anybody. Also,
Ademola says and unlocks his phone,
give me your number. I have a cousin in London who owns a plumbing company. He'll give you family rates.
Harry, wildly confused, because Ademola Musa was supposed to be a kind, intelligent football star, not someone with an almost Secret Service level of knowledge about his life, and apparently his personal and business problems, recites his number. Draco air kisses Ademola goodbye. Harry doesn't miss Ademola's knowing wink, or Draco's answering flush. Their hands are getting sweaty together. Draco drops it to fasten the seatbelt in the back of the chauffeured car, then pounces on it as soon as Harry's done struggling with his own seatbelt. They don't say anything. Draco stares at him. So he stares back. Harry has grown broader and softer, and the rounder circumference of his bicep shuts down Draco's brain. They couldn't even speak if they wanted to, because their mind has just become a stuttered, sutured repetition of Harry's name. Harry got stuck on the dark veins of Draco's wrist, how they corded out from the back of his pale hands, almost ghoulishly purple. How the dark ink of his tattoos blurs along the edges. He wants to know them all, feel how the ink raises his skin, unravel the meaning of each flower in the bouquet growing up his arm. The chauffeur pulls up in front of a hotel. Draco thanks him in French. Probably perfect French, because he's French or whatever now, Harry thinks, and hates the Dursleys for denying him any language but English. The elevator takes 10,000 years to arrive, and to go up the floors and the hallway is 1,000,000 miles long. Then they're in a hotel room. There's a king-size bed with blindingly white sheets. There's a television the size of a fireplace. Champagne. Draco drops Harry's hand. Harry wants to grab it back. But he waits, because he wasn't the one who would run. Draco glances up at Harry, because they're still shorter, and that sparks an irritation that smacks of their childish rivalry, and says simply,
I'm sorry.
Draco puts their hands on Harry's waist, hoping beyond hope that they won't get smacked away, because two words can't make up for all that lost time.
I was wrong to leave. I didn't know what to do with the... You were everything I ever wanted, since forever, and I didn't know how to handle it.
They look up and meet Harry's green eyes. Harry swallows around a lump in his throat and chokes out.
What? Ah, Draco says. If you'd still want me.
Harry watches the fear flicker across those pointed features. It's as if he can see Draco's heart, unguarded. He bends his head and kisses Draco, briefly, chastely. A promise. He's never been the best with words, not in the way where he chooses them carefully because they have meanings and valences, but he understands tenses and actions, and the shine in Draco's eyes when he pulls his head back. But he tries to form his thoughts into something good, because he knows it's important.
I still want you, and I will still want you for the rest of my life, because
God knows, I've tried to find happiness in all these other places, and there was still something missing. Someone missing, he says, and rests his forehead against Draco's. Draco can't rest in the moment. They pull their head back. I'm non-binary, Draco blurts. I'm not a man. You said you were bi, and I don't know if that... And I don't know what I'm going to do about the FA and coming out about that, but fuck, that's not relevant right now, and... But you had to know before this goes any farther, because I don't want to hide anything from you, because you deserve the truth, the whole truth. Okay, Harry says, twining his arms around Draco's waist. What pronouns do you use? You can't just say okay, Draco says, fighting the urge to melt into Harry. Don't you have questions? But also, they. I think that's where I've settled for now. Okay, Harry says, and kisses Draco's forehead. But you're bi, Draco says, fighting the feeling of calm that's threatening to engulf them, because it can't. It shouldn't be this easy. Draco, Harry says, his voice stern. Don't be stupid. Do you want a whole Tumblr essay with citations from the 1970s about how bi has always included non-binary and trans people? Do you think that's what I care about right now? When I've been thinking about you for 9 fucking years and I'm hoping I'm like 5-10 minutes away from getting you into bed and you think I'm going to have a crisis because you're non-binary now? Draco chokes a little and heat rises to their cheeks. 5 minutes. I will give you that essay later, Harry says, with citations. Then he slides one hand up to Draco's cheek. He kisses them with such tenderness that Draco's heart cracks open at once. It is this easy, this simple, this comfortable and kind and hot, Draco supposes, as they rip off Harry's shirt and drag him onto the bed. This time, Harry thinks, it's more like a film, but with dumb human sounds instead of a symphony and violins. It's the extended cut, but without cuts, because he can see the whole thing unraveling in front of his eyes because it's his fucking life, and he gets to kiss Draco until their words dissolve into incoherent babble, and it's his back Draco scratches, and his earlobe Draco nibbles, and they make the same small noises as in those half-remembered fragments, which he'd worried he'd worn away through repeated remembering, or overwritten them with his own fantasies. But no, Draco moans in the same breathy way and gives Harry that same challenging, tender look as their bodies slide into place, into a rhythm. There's a sated silence. Harry pushes his hair back and feels the sweat drying beneath his fingers as they drag across Draco's back. That was more like a minute, Harry says at last with a laugh, then kisses the top of Draco's head to prove that he's not making fun of them, not really. Despite your blushing act, you're pretty straightforward. I'm a striker. Draco pushes themselves up onto their elbows. I know how to put it in the back of the net. I don't know what the fuck that means, Harry says. He squints at Draco, because, of course, his glasses are probably somewhere on the floor. But they're not, because Draco carefully folded them and put them on the nightstand. Until Draco huffs and flops down on Harry's chest, their faces inches away. My timing is impeccable, Draco says, according to the pundits. I think it's a bit slow, but, Harry sighs, you've put it in the net or whatever now, and you better be damn well stuck in this net for a while. That doesn't even make sense, Draco says with a groan. But they lean up and kiss Harry until they can't breathe, and then they curl into his side. It feels so safe, kind, warm. He's solid and smells of sweat, and his chest hair tickles Draco's nose. His beard has rubbed Draco's face a bit raw, but they don't mind, and it might, even annoyingly, be kind of hot. Draco knows they're not going to get over how irritatingly attractive Harry is. A vision of graying Harry flits through their mind, and they suppress a groan. Who decided this was allowed? Who made him so irresistible? Harry wraps his arm around Draco and knows he's never going to let go. Metaphorically, anyway, because they're going to have to take showers and go to work and the grocery store and have a fight in an IKEA, and he knows he's going to have to clean his flat and one day find his mother's ring, and one of them will walk down that aisle to the other one, and there will be a sunny kitchen and tears and thousands of cups of coffee, and all those things require a letting go so there can be a coming back. He bends his head and presses his lips against Draco's hair. Draco feels the pressure. Their eyes flutter open. Then, just as their eyes begin to close, they feel more than see. Tangled around their intertwined bodies, a filament of light drawn between two hearts. Chapter 11. An Epilogue. Mary Imogen Ellis Clark waved a chubby fist at the priest as he sprinkled the holy water over her head. She squawked. Harry grinned at Martin's sister, who was supporting Mary's head over the font. Her lips twitched. Martin was openly sobbing. Morwenna glowed. The full moon had been last week, so the druids had already gotten their blessings in. Harry wasn't sure if it was legit to have a godfather who'd never stepped inside a church until that morning, but no one asked that many questions. He'd take care of her, God forbid anything happened, and realized, with a jolt of panic, that he had 4 godchildren, a veritable brood. If Hermione and Ron and Martin and Morwenna and Andy and Narcissa died, he'd... Fuck it. Grimmauld was huge. He found Draco in the pews. Draco smiled at him. Sarah nudged him, and he took Mary in his arms. The priest was saying stuff. He fought the urge to raise her up like Simba. Morwenna had one keen eye on him and one on her husband, whose sobs had subsided into a shiny-faced happiness. Harry handed her back to Martin, and she settled in and fell asleep immediately, looking like the cherub she was in her long baptismal gown, which nearly tripped up her hapless father. But for a quick spell, Morwenna mumbled when no one was really looking. He tangled his fingers in Draco's on the way down the aisle. His hand wriggled into the correct place, relishing the strangeness of the cold press of Draco's gold band. His mother's ring, all filigreed and knotted golden threads, stunned Draco into silence. Life was stranger than fate. They weren't silent now, whispering to Hermione, and whatever it was made her laugh, until Leo craned his head over Ron's shoulder and babbled at his mother, which only made Draco smirk and wave one hand at the latest Granger Weasley and say, "One day I'll let you know, Leo, but you're still quite small." Ellie, who'd claimed Harry's other hand, cleared her throat and stared Draco down.
"Mum says that all topics can be explained to children unless one has psychological hang-ups," Hermione said with a smile.
"Or you're too stupid to be able to simplify it," Ellie continued.
Draco grinned at her and switched to French, which they'd tricked her into speaking by promising that they could tell secrets in it, and the bickering went on. Harry floated along down the aisle, knowing he couldn't really float away because of the 2 hands in his own that belonged to 2 highly opinionated people who loved him to the end of time. These were his people, his family. He didn't even have to try to smile for the photo.